Okay, well, it's a pleasure to be here, and maybe I should feel intimidated, I think, because there's several people here who know probably more than I do about some of these things, so hopefully they will step in to correct me if I go wrong. I started out as an undergraduate in biophysics, went into molecular biology and then back into X-ray crystallography, and then for 10 years I've been doing almost completely just computational things at SDSC. So I sort of wandered around through the boundary between sort of hard sciences and biological sciences. What I'm going to do today is hopefully give you some entry points to some of the pretty large literature that revolves around multiple sequence alignments, and I have quite a bit of stuff, but I think we'll get through it, so feel free to interrupt me as we go along. Most of it is not highly quantitative, that is, it's not oriented towards algorithms and proofs, it's mostly more application-oriented and method-oriented, partly because that's the way I think about things, and partly because I don't think we have enough time to go into a lot of the details on some of the math, and that is out there pretty much in the literature now. All right, so let me just start with, why do people want to make multiple alignments? There's three main reasons, and I'll talk briefly about these before we go on. One is to make phylogenies or trees, to try to see how organisms or genes are related. One is, and I think the most important one, to make a kind of informational map. That is to say, if I have some new molecule, I've done the genomic sequence, I pulled this sequence out of the genome, I want to know something about what it does functionally, chemically, biologically. The way I'm going to find that out is to find a homologous molecule and to map information from what I know about that other molecule that maybe has been studied in the lab for many years onto this new molecule. And that's one of the key advances, maybe you could say the key advance that's made molecular biology enormously successful in the last 20 years, is it hasn't been necessary to do that 20 years of base experimental lab work on every single molecule. A lot of it can be assumed based on what you map on, based on sequence alignments, and multiple sequence alignments are part of that. These days you see a lot of times this activity is conflated with ortholog identification. I don't think most people who are trying to find orthologs care whether they're orthologs or not. I think okay, ortholog, I think everyone knows, probably heard what homology is, right? Homology meaning descent from a common ancestor. An ortholog is a particular kind of descent where you believe the molecule you're looking at is having the same function. Okay, so let's see. Maybe I should put this up. I think I can just use the one screen on the side. So a good example would be hemoglobin. Hemoglobin is a tetrameric molecule made of alpha and beta chains. The alpha and beta chains of hemoglobin diverged from some common ancestor many millions of years ago, probably back, around the time of fish, I think, arising. So 300 or 400 million years ago. In every mammal, therefore, if you look at horse, you look at human, we have an alpha and a beta. Horse has an alpha and a beta. Okay, alpha and beta are both homologous to alpha and beta because they come from a common ancestor. Alpha in horse is homologous to beta in human. But it's the two alphas that are orthologs and the two betas that are orthologs. And the alpha compared to this beta is what's called a paralog. Okay. That's just nomenclature that I think Walter Fitch introduced that originally. the reason why you care if something is an ortholog is because you assume if it has this relationship that there was divergence of species after divergence of the molecules, and in fact the alphas in each case are having the same function, that you can really directly map chemical, functional, structural information from one to the other. So that leads to the final thing, which I think we don't do very much of, but we'll do more of, which is prediction of structure and function. I think that will become increasingly important, but is perhaps still not being done that well. All right, so here's an example of a tree. And this is what you'd call a gene tree. Every one of these little branches coming out here is a different gene sequence. This is a family of protein kinase molecules found in plants. What we'd like to be able to do, and what people try to do, is to say, look at one of these branches. Say you look at this main branch that comes out here, branch 2, is you'd like to be able to say that there's some distinction of structure and function about that branch that distinguishes it, say, from this branch, that the difference in the sequence is correlated with the difference in structure and function. And in a lot of cases, that's true. It's not so clear for this case because we just don't know enough about these molecules. To get that kind of a tree, you have to have a multiple alignment, and you have to have a correct multiple alignment, because the trees are dependent on the multiple alignments in a very detailed and intimate way, and that should become clear as we go on today. I tried to come up with a quick example of this sort of information mapping idea, and I pulled one off of one of our websites. This is several different sequences of some protein kinases. This top one, CAPKA, there's a lot known about this molecule. It's been studied for a long time. There's a three-dimensional crystal structure known. It's known, for instance, that in this area right here, there's a flap of the molecule that comes down over the substrate, which is an ATP molecule, to hold it in the active site. Okay. These other molecules that aren't well studied, like these ones that start D, are from Drosophila, I think. What you'd like to do is be able to make that same assumption, or to take it as a hypothesis at least, that because we get a good multiple alignment here, that this region is performing the same function. That obviates 10, 15 maybe years of experiments at the bench. You can immediately go to, for instance, doing in vitro mutagenesis, changing some of the important residues in here, and have a big head start on things. And that's what's been enormously successful for molecular biology. And I assume sometime later people talk about structure prediction and things, so I'm not going to talk much about it. I will just point out there is a underlying thread that behind all of what we do with sequences, that there's a one-to-one correspondence of sequences to structure. This is an example of a feature called an EF hand motif. It's an alpha helix that comes up, makes a little loop, alpha helix down on the back. It binds a calcium molecule in this loop region. If you look at the conserved residues of those sequences and you line them up and you shade the ones that are actually conserved, these red ones here, mostly charged, are the residues that line this loop and are ligands to the calcium. They're conserved because they have to be able to make the right kind of hydrophilic interaction with the calcium, a hydrogen bond. This glycine is actually conserved and nearly invariant because one of these residues, I think it's over here, is positioned so that the ligand of the calcium is the carbonyl oxygen of that residue. And the only way you can point a carbonyl in at that angle is if you have a residue with no side chain. So you have to have this glycine residue. Weaker patterns that you can see are these blue patterns. Okay, these are hydrophobic patches. These are actually the hydrophobic patches on the surface of these helices, where those two helices stack together and are glued by hydrophobic effect, if you will. You can see the periodicity of roughly 3 to 4 residues in these hydrophobic residues, and that's because of the periodicity of the alpha helices. Okay, so that's the kinds of things currently we can deduce from multiple sequence alignments, and what we'd like to do is be able to go much further than that. I don't think a huge amount of power has actually been applied to that particular problem yet. Now let me start with a metaphor. Alignment, and especially multiple sequence alignment, is often looked at as a metaphor, and speech recognition is a common way to look at it. That you have some speaker that's emitting a sentence, and that could, except for the presence of this O, that could be a real amino acid sequence of a protein. There's some kind of a noise process, and we receive in the world a variety of corrupted versions of this message. So the problem then, from that point of view, is given these corrupted versions of the message, to actually deduce what the real message was. Okay, I'm not sure this is a great metaphor, and I'm going to give you a few reasons why I think it's not a great metaphor. Okay, so basically what that's saying is when we go around to different species, or even in one species, we look at molecules that have been duplicated and then diverged in one species, that these different instances of the proteins are some different version of a signal, that there's actually some sort of teleological purpose to the cell. It's trying to say a particular protein message, and it's just being corrupted by noise. That noise would then be in the form of random mutations. Now, we know that's not true, especially in the case of proteins that are duplicated, that in fact those proteins are active under somewhat different conditions. They have somewhat different specificities. Whether those are random effects, and originally they're obviously random effects, but ultimately they become very important and sometimes critically important to the way the cell works. I think that kind of assumption actually has been implicitly behind a certain amount of the stuff you see published. Okay. So this doesn't show up very well. This is an actual molecule. So if you will, this would be the, it's a little better. This would be the thing the speaker was trying to say. And that would be being realized as several different sentences, and this is a small multiple alignment. And you can see there's a variety of changes. They're very conserved in here. This is actually the active site of a protein kinase, and there's differences in other places. But that nevertheless, each one of these sequences would fold up into something approximating that structure, and I think the key word here is approximating, because matching structures is a whole different problem that I'm not going to talk about. Okay, so really there's not just one of those structures that in fact the cell would like to say. There's a number of different structures. So you might want to make your metaphor a little more complicated and actually have several different kinds of speakers actually saying slightly different things. Then there's a noise process that goes on, and they get kind of mixed up together, and it's a little hard to tell which ones are which. I think this is more like the reality that we're dealing with, and in particular, situations like this, where a bit of one message can get cut off and hooked onto a different message. This happens in the cell all the time. You see bits of one molecule that are swapped with another molecule, and it becomes very difficult to figure out what's going on. So you can say, yeah, I could probably even deal with this situation. I can make some kind of a multi-component model where I try to, in fact, deduce, based on these sequences, the three different messages that were there. Okay, but the situation is even more complicated than that. Okay, so the first thing you have to keep in mind is these messages, if you will, are differing by some biological process. They're differing by a mutational process, which is in itself non-random. Okay, but we don't actually get to observe many of the mutations. So we don't get to observe much of the random noise. What we observe are fixed mutations, mutations that survive and persist in the population. So there's a winnowing process that enhances the non-randomness of the noise you get considerably. And in fact, directs the insertions and deletions. If we go back to this, the mutational differences that you see are specifically directed to the surface areas of the proteins that don't disrupt the overall folding of the protein, especially little loops like this or like this, where probably you can do almost anything you want on that loop there. You can hook on a whole nother big piece there, and it's not really going to disrupt this protein. And in fact, that happens all the time in nature. There is a very tight coupling of the sequence changes that are allowed then to the structure. It's difficult to make changes in the core of the structure. There's some sort of a landscape of changes. Certainly, where having made some change in the core, you can still retain your function by making compensating changes in other places. But that's a multi-mutation process and less common. Okay. What's even more important, and the thing that makes the sort of multiple speaker analogy least appropriate, is the fact that there is a pronounced hierarchical relationship between the molecules. So we don't, not only do we not have a random sample because of the difficulty of going out and randomly sampling things in biology and sequencing lots of things at random, but the sample we get is implicitly hierarchical because of the chain of descent of the molecules. First, say, a protein is duplicated, and then each of its if you will, daughters are duplicated again. That hierarchicalness makes it very difficult to get back at this idea of a perfect message. And so maybe that's not a good metaphor at all, and we should throw it out, and that's what I would suggest. So this hierarchical relationship between the molecules is the key, I think, the key confounding problem that makes multiple alignment difficult, because it conflates the problem of getting the alignment right with the problem of getting the tree that relates the molecule right. Okay, and they're very interdependent. A given alignment implies a certain tree. A given tree implies a certain alignment. There are currently no methods that will solve that problem, that will give you simultaneously an optimal tree and an optimal alignment. So that's what's been called sometimes the big phylogeny problem. I think that's a problem that people are due to take back up. Okay, so I'm going to talk about four different kinds of approaches. And I'm not going to talk much about the phylogeny problem, because I know that you're going to have a long session on phylogeny later on in this series, but it will come into what we talk about several times, mostly in this section here. So I'm going to start with talking a little bit about multidimensional dynamic programming. I'll spend a little more time on progressive alignments, and then I'll deal with something called leader-follower alignments or master-slave alignments, which are, I think, in many ways, well, I think they're becoming quite popular right now. And then at the end, I want to talk something about what you could more loosely call local alignment methods, methods that don't give you complete multiple alignments, but just bits out of the proteins. Any questions so far? Okay. So I understand that last week you talked all week about pairwise alignments. So if you think about a pairwise alignment, we can just look at the face of this cube for a second. you fill in some sort of a score matrix where you lay out one sequence on one axis and another sequence on another axis. And you fill out a score matrix where each one of the cells corresponds to a score for the end of an alignment. You can then find the best alignment by finding the best score. That you can generalize that to as many dimensions as you want. You can do an alignment with three sequences, then you have this whole cube to fill in. Same thing, every cell in this cube corresponds to the end of a three-way alignment. Okay, now, that's all well and good. The only problem is that that doesn't scale in any practical way. In fact, it only scales up probably to seven or eight sequences before you start to have really serious and challenging computational problems. There was a lot of interest in this, I'd say, at the end of the 1980s and in the early 1990s. And Steve Altschul, who was here last week, was one of the key players in this. Carrillo and Lippmann described an approach to this which makes a great deal of sense, which is to say, if you look at this cube, or if you looked at some bigger multidimensional cube, each one of the faces of this cube is a two-dimensional alignment. And you can use the fact that you know that it's an optimal two-dimensional alignment to put constraints on where the optimal n-dimensional alignment has to lie in this n-dimensional hypercube. Okay, and basically you do that by projecting each of the faces of this cube into the center and laying out some sort of an ellipsoid. Okay. Now, so what you know going in is that the multiple dimensional alignment can't be better than the pairwise optimal alignment. And it's not possible for an alignment of three sequences to produce a pairwise alignment that's any better than what you would get for the two sequences, because it has more constraints. How do you score it? That's another question, which I'll get to in a second. But basically, you score it as the sum of the pairs of the aligned residues. That's a pretty elegant solution. It allows you to do a real multi-dimensional alignment with up to, I don't know, you probably even go up to around 20 sequences today. It's depends a lot on how closely related the sequences are. The more closely related, the stronger the constraints of pairwise alignments put on the multidimensional alignment. Okay, so Ralph just asked the scoring system. One of the problems, and one of the reasons why I think why multiple alignments isn't a solved problem, is because it's not exactly clear what to use for a scoring system. And some of the earliest choice, and the choice that's been used for most of the work, has been to use the sum of the pairs of the aligned residues. So if you have some alignment, like that, you just take and do a sum across all the pairs, look up those pairwise scores in a table, a two-dimensional table, like the ones I think were discussed last week, a Blossom or a PAM type table. Okay. The problem with that is that makes an assumption about the relationship of the molecules to each other. And in fact, it makes an assumption that the molecules correspond to what's called a star phylogeny, so that if you have five taxa, that they relate to each other by divergence from a common point. Each one of these pairwise distances and all the other ones has equal weight. Okay, so you're saying, let's take our sequence data and we'll force it to agree with a tree that looks like this. And in fact, that's not what real biological molecules look like. They don't come from a tree that looks like this, very seldom sometimes, very seldom. All right, so for a number of reasons, real n-dimensional alignments are impossible. And the key issue is, if you take the kind of problems, say, I was working on this weekend, we have groups of sequences that range from, say, 80 or 90 up to 300 or 400 that we need to get multiple alignments for. I don't think there's any chance that we're ever going to do that as a real n-dimensional alignment. And even if we did, we would still have this problem that the assumptions behind it are wrong. And in fact, the alignments we get out aren't the alignments we want. So this was realized.
These are gapless?
No, these are alignments with gaps. Okay. Yes, it would be global alignments. I think you can implement this for local alignments too, but I'm not sure anyone has. Okay. So these are the fundamental papers. There's a couple of other people I should mention who worked on this. There were a number of papers that all came out in the early 90s, and the other people who worked on this and had interesting solutions to it were Michael Zucker and Goto. And I can get through those references. I think they're probably referenced if you look at any general book on computational biology, like Mike Waterman's book or some of the other ones. So I think this was a start that set off a little flurry of work on multiple alignments. And then sort of the next wave that came after that really was what I want to talk about next, which is progressive alignments. So almost all the multiple alignments that are published or that people use today are what we call progressive alignments. So you make these alignments by using basically a pairwise alignment procedure. You grow an alignment by some hierarchical procedure where you start with, say, the two nearest sequences, align those, fix that alignment and don't let it change, align the next nearest sequence. Okay. Those kinds of alignments are computationally tractable. It's, I don't know, the biggest alignments I've made probably have close to 1,000 different sequences in them. Those sequences may be 500 or 600 long. Okay, so those are very large compared to what you could do by, if you will, an exact method. Every kind of progressive alignment method has underneath it some assumption of what the hierarchy of the molecules is that goes in to make that alignment. And I'll show you two different approaches to that to give you some idea of the difference it might make. I'll talk about that. The order is picked by a method that's basically a tree building method. I'll come back to that. So I think I'll answer that question. One of the problems with this is there's an inherent circularity. People want to use these methods to make phylogenies. The multiple alignment method has implicit in it a phylogeny that it uses to construct the alignment. It's not surprising then if you take the output of these methods and use a variety of different tree building methods on them, you tend to get a tree back that looks like the method you used as a guide tree for the alignment to start with. So this is a fairly pathological kind of situation. The answer to this basically has been that you can get an automatic multiple alignment, but you have to hand edit it afterwards to remove this bias of the guide tree from it. Okay. All right, so there's a basic procedure almost all methods follow. First, you take your group of sequences. You need to determine distances between them. Maybe I should move this up a little bit and make it smaller. Those distances can be a variety of things. They're commonly pairwise alignment distances determined by some pairwise dynamic programming program. There's no reason it couldn't be something else, and some programs use a faster method, a word-based method like what's behind FASTA or BLAST. Then you use a tree construction method that uses a table of distances to create a guide tree, which is an addition order that you're going to add the sequences to a growing alignment. And you add the sequences in that order to come up with a multiple alignment. Okay. I'm going to tell you about two methods quickly. One is very simple. One is, I think, quite sophisticated. Clustel W is a method that almost all the naive alignments that I see published in molecular biology papers use. It's what almost all the websites or things that generate automatic alignments will show you.
On the first one, as you go up in this progressive alignment, do you change the score measures like PAM, whatever?
So that's one of the differences between a simple method like PILEP. PILEP uses a single scoring table at all levels of the hierarchy. Clustel actually modifies the scoring system it uses depending on the measured distance between the proteins. It's quite...
Yeah, just very basic because I'm not using it. So now the procedure design for this kind of progressive multiple alignment is still independent from what you do with scores, right?
The procedure for the alignment is independent from the procedure you use to get the guide tree or the hierarchical addition order to build the alignment. There's no reason they have to be the same algorithm.
Do you think you need to give a very specific example
of three or four different outline orders? Okay, so let me do that. I'll skip ahead a few slides. So here's an example of some sequences, simple sequences, and they have some relationship between them. Okay, this one is shorter than the others. Okay, so by some method, and maybe by doing preliminary pairwise alignments between these, we come up with a table of distances between these, and we use a tree building method, which I'll show you in a second, to get this tree. Okay, so then we start, we see these two tacks are closest, so we build an alignment of just those two. Okay, that requires us to put an insertion here. And having done that, we freeze this alignment then, and we go on to the next node in the tree, which is, in this case, is to add this sequence. We add that one in, leaving this lower alignment frozen. So we're aligning, if you will, to the consensus of those two. And then finally, we go on to the next stage. And there's no reason this branch coming in couldn't, in fact, have two things already aligned. We'd be aligning two things to three things. Those two sub-alignments are fixed. And all we can do is add insertions and deletions between the two groups. Does that make sense?
But still, you could have chosen AATG instead of AASG over here, right?
I could have chosen AATG instead of, for the tree. I could have chosen a different addition order, and that depends on the method I use to create this guide tree.
But it isn't unreadable tree.
I think for this application it doesn't matter if it's rooted or unrooted. It's just an order of joining things together. Okay, so a few points about that. One point is, let me say what's on this slide before I go on. I think Russ Doolittle pointed it out most succinctly. He said, once a gap, always a gap is the rule. Okay, so once you've inserted a gap in alignment, it stays there forever. It's critical, yeah.
So when you do something like, I first put things that are very similar and then I align them to which I'm quite sure.
That's right. So the rationale is to start with the alignments that you have the best information on, that is for the sequences which are most alike. And those are the alignments that are least ambiguous. To make those first and then to move out to alignments where the information is poorer and to do those last. Yeah. Would I get a different alignment? In this case, I probably wouldn't, but in real life, it would make a big difference. In real life, these two, we probably wouldn't have two sequences. If these two sequences would probably be neighbors to each other in the tree because they're so similar. Let me go ahead.
Could you leave it for a second?
Okay.
You could have taken the two sequences AAPG and AAPG and worked with them as a substrate.
Absolutely.
So you would have gotten even a cell tree.
So every one of these progressive alignment methods has a method that it uses to construct this guide tree, this order of addition tree. And there's a lot of well-known methods that people, they're the same methods people use to build phylogenetic trees. The different methods may give different answers for the same data. Yeah. Well, this is an issue of great contention in the systematics world, is which methods in building trees give correct trees and under what circumstances. I don't think there's a final answer to that, mostly because nobody knows the correct answer for enough real-life situations to be able to pick one method.
For this case, you choose the closest pair, then.
Yeah. So let me just give an example of the guide tree. One common method that let me go back to some slide. Call this okay. So I have my four sequences. I want to just make a distance matrix that shows the number of distance between them. We use some sort of simple distance, like just the string edit distance, counting gaps as one and changes as one. So in that case, the distance between 1 and 2 is 2. The distance between 1 and 3 is 1. The distance between 1 and 4 is also 1. 2 to 3 is 1. 2 to 4 is 2, and 3 to 4 is 1. Okay. Did I do it wrong?
1 and 4 is smaller than the distance between 2.
Because you have to make at least two changes to get from 2 to 4. You have to delete one residue and you have to change one. I'm just doing this off of my head, so it's not impossible I've made mistakes. Okay, so this is the kind of data, very crudely, and of course when you do it over the length of a real sequence, it's 300 or 400 long, of course there's much less likely you'll have identical numbers. The simplest method people use is something called UPGMA, which means unweighted pair group method of averages. Okay. The method is very simple. What you do is you look into this table, you find the smallest value. Okay, in the case where we have identical values, I guess we'd have some way to choose between them. But let's say we just chose this. That was really the smallest. What we do then is we put those two taxa together, so that would be 1 and 4. Then we replace the values in this table with the average of the distances from those two merge taxa to everything else. And so that's why it's an average method. So we would take out the, we can get rid of the 4 line. They both have a distance to that one of 2. They both have a distance to that one of 1. So in fact, the average is precisely this row we already have. And then we have no more 4. Then we look in the table that's left. Oh, no 4. Table that's left, and we pick the shortest distance. That would be one of these two, maybe 3. Okay, then we do the same thing. We merge them together. We average the distances from that group to get the distance from the group to everyone else. Okay, and then we go on to the next step. We just do it till we exhaust this distance matrix. So that's a very simple method. It's a method that it's one of the oldest ones that people use for building trees. People still use it today because, in fact, in a lot of situations, it performs pretty well. Okay, so all right, so one thing you have to pay attention to when you do this is this: what happens to the gaps? Okay, so I put a gap in here at this stage of the alignment. Okay, that's a cost that I pay for aligning this residue to a blank space, and that corresponds to somewhere along one of these branches a residue being lost or a residue being gained. When I add on this next sequence, okay, I don't need to pay that gap cost again. I've already paid whatever cost it takes to either add or delete a residue along one of these branches down here. When I'm adding this in, I'm really adding in this part of the tree. I don't need to pay that gap cost a second time.
So this means that while you're building up these profiles, whatever, the distances that you've already constructed change because of the fact that if there's a gap or whatever, you may have counted in building the tree, and now you have to.
So that's a good point. Once you've made the guide tree, you don't remake it as you go. You just use it as a fixed addition order. Now, maybe that would make things better. Maybe it wouldn't.
But if I had a gap in, for instance, AATG, that sequence, would then there be a penalty?
A gap in this one here.
Right.
Then we would pay a penalty again. Because those would have to be on two different branches. So they'd have to be two distinct biological events. So what you're trying to do, approximate, is making your distances resemble the distance along the branches of the tree. Okay. So as was just pointed out, the way this is done as you go along is to create a little table, okay, that tells you, okay, for instance, I've made a little table here of 4 different residues, and these are the 4 positions, okay, and these are just counts of residues. In reality, we use some kind of scores. So after I've made this alignment, I have 2 A's, 2 A's, 1 S, and 1G. In reality, I'd probably want to also record that I had 1 gap character there. As I go up and add another one, I can augment this matrix. So it's pretty easy to see that you can use just these counts to look up an average score versus the new sequence you're bringing in one of these pairwise scoring matrices. Okay. So if I have, for instance, in this position, I have 1A and 2Gs. And I'm aligning in this next one, which is this one, G. I can look up the average score for 1A and 2Gs compared to G to get the score for aligning that G with this column here. Is that clear?
It's a little bit bizarre, though, because I could imagine the same Hibbler's logic for gaps is also true for sequence substitutions as well. You know, that so the idea of taking an average and building up a profile that way seems to be sort of counting substitutions multiple times, even though they may be just one substitution. And so it seems like there's a little bit of inconsistency in terms of how it deals with deletion versus
substitution. What that average is representing is an estimate of an ancestral residue. So you could actually use a maximum likelihood estimate of what that ancestral residue does or was, but it would be very computationally expensive to compute.
I'm just thinking if you have 180 G's and 1 A, as long as that's what's off at the beginning, that is equally likely to have been an A or a G.
That's right.
Here, you would say, oh,
that's right.
Going against the one substitution.
So I agree completely. Now, what happens is you can perform a weighting on these branches. So in fact, just because you saw, let's see, one A here and two G's in this last position, you don't have to count them as one, because you know these two are correlated because they descended from one common ancestor. And so maybe you should be counting something that's much closer to 50% A and G instead of 2 to 1 G. And you can calculate that and put it in to your scoring system as you build these, if you want to call these profiles of the residues as you go up the tree.
I'm surprised in all of these algorithms, like likelihood calculations and things like that, scale very nicely going from the bottom and working your way up to the top, which is exactly what you're doing here. So it seems strange that it is computationally too expensive to just do, not to do the likelihood calculation if you go up. Just because you're always just considering the two daughter nodes where you are, and just ignoring everything else beyond that.
Well, I suppose you could. What makes it computationally expensive? I think it's probably within the power of what we do today to do a much better job. There's reasons why you might not want to do that, or maybe you wouldn't think it's worthwhile. Okay, and let me get on to that.
So basically, when you sort of align 1 and 4, for example, in this case, the third one, you weigh now actually the computer score basically is 15 units from
4 here?
Yeah.
Okay, so adding this to this table.
And basically, you just align the sequence to both the third one, to both the
that's
right.
Right. So
now you just do two alignments in this case.
In this case, we just have to do one alignment because these two are fixed to each other.
Those are fixed, right? So basically, you use the average, the score you use for substitution or gapping is basically the average over the profile already exists.
That's the simplest thing to do. Okay, and that's what actually this program called Pileup does. It does the very simplest thing. It doesn't try to adjust for the branching pattern in lower nodes. It just does uses counts. Okay, so I think people perceive some of the problems with this. The biggest problem with this is basically a greedy solution. Okay, it's definitely not guaranteed to be optimal, and it's most programs don't have a strong enough idea of what an optimal sequence alignment actually is to even be able to tell if their alignment was optimal. But it's highly likely that this procedure is going to get trapped in some suboptimal local solution. And some of the biggest problems are, the whole rationale for starting with the closest sequences and putting them together first is they're the most alike. You're least likely to make a mistake in your alignment. Obviously, once you make a mistake in your pairwise alignments and get things wrong, that mistake propagates all the way up the tree, and it just gets worse is as soon as you start to lose information by making a mistake, aligning the wrong things, it either leads you towards the wrong solution or just decreases the information available for the correct solution. There's no general way, or maybe there is now, there's no general way to choose the correct alignment parameters to get the correct alignment. And it's not obvious, it's not at all obvious that at each stage in the tree that those parameters shouldn't be changing as you move from the leaf nodes up to the root node of that tree. In particular, we know that things like insertions and deletions tend to be less common events that tend to happen over longer distances of time, and they're much rarer between sequences that are very closely related. And you'd think some change in the gap penalties as you went from the leaf nodes to the root of the tree ought to be going on. It's also true when you look at families of sequences that at the very highest level, you look at the things that are close to the root of the tree that break them into classes, it's often the presence of very large block insertions and deletions that lets you identify the major classes. So those seem to give you lots of information about the deep nodes in the tree. Missense, sort of random mutation information, gives you a lot more information about the leaf nodes of the tree. And this, I don't think, is systematically taken advantage of.
You possibly to define mathematically the optimization problem that one wants to solve?
That's something I wanted to come back to later. I think you can make a number of different definitions. The ones that have been most commonly used, which is this sum of pairs definition, is I think almost certainly the wrong one. Some definition more like an information content or something like that is probably more like the right one, in my opinion.
I was going to pursue along the same line. Suppose have a model of evolution, like some sort of a PAM thing plus insertion deletion, and you start from the very beginning, have some ancestor sequence which you don't know, and apply these to it, and so the result will, say, be the observed sequences. Can you do a maximum likelihood on that? Or would that be the optimal?
You have to know the tree to be able to do the maximum likelihood calculation. Okay, so the problem is that the sum of the, or the number of possible topologies for the tree grows as a product of two factorials. And so by the time you get up to a relatively small number of taxa, like 10, you have too many trees to enumerate.
But it's just to know if that is the aim or not.
Well, if you could do that, I would think that would be great. So I think another good criterion function for the maximum, for the best multiple alignment would be the multiple alignment that lets you construct the tree with the minimum distance, the most compact tree, so that the sum of the branch lengths along that tree were minimized. Okay. That requires joint solution of the tree in the alignment.
It seems this idea of integrating over trees is exactly the right one.
I mean, there's one issue of defining what's a problem, and then you do a transformation.
So I think something in between there is definitely possible, and you can use the same idea that was used for the n-dimensional alignment. You can use the pairwise alignments, and you can tell when you look at the pairs of sequences. There's some clusters, and there's some that you don't even have to consider. So there's lots of tree topologies you could exclude. This is definitely something nobody's really tried.
Now, it seems to be that obviously you really want to get down to the topology, maybe I'm wrong on this, but I mean, so you look at my envelope and construct a tree, but presumably the topology doesn't change among species, right? And it's kind of common ancestors. So just look at another gene. Look at another gene. And I imagine thinking you narrow down the topology precisely on.
Well, unfortunately, most genes don't occur as single gene. They usually occur as multi-gene families. And when those multi-gene families get duplicated and proliferate varies within the phylogenetic tree. Overlaid on that is the fact that after the genes get duplicated, like a myoglobin-like gene being duplicated to form two hemoglobin-like genes, at some point, they assume a new function. That's functional change affects the selection and puts a drive on the protein sequence to go to some other optimized peak, if you will, in sequence space. So it gets very complicated. Okay, so for instance, most of the trees we make, we don't make species trees, we make gene trees. In any particular organism that we're looking at, if we look at something like a calcium-dependent protein kinase, there's 40 of those in Arabidopsis. There's probably an equivalent number in other plants. Some of the elaboration of these multiple types has happened since the divergence of the species, and some of it happened before. We're not completely sure at this point where that cutoff is, because we don't have enough information from species other than Arabidopsis, which is the only completely sequenced plant. You look a little puzzled. So the main idea is that within a single organism, genes will be duplicated. Each one of those duplicated genes over time, probably through some random process, assumes a somewhat different function. Because its properties drift off from its ancestral properties due to random process of mutation. And then when those different properties have some utility, there's actually a drive then for further sequence change to make it optimize its new function. So you're relying on a time-like property of the mutational process, that it acts like a random clock. There's a random accumulation of noise. And that's true as long as you have two proteins who have the same function and function in the same environment. But as soon as there's some kind of active selection that for a different structure or a different function, the time-like quality is gone now, and you have some kind of directed evolution. So the distances then become completely unreliable. So that's why for making trees, a lot of people prefer to make trees based on nucleotide data, and they will only look at changes in the third position of the codon, because those changes normally don't change the encoded amino acid. Okay, so it's a random clock-like distance. Okay, we never have that a pure situation of that looking at protein sequences, because there's always an aspect of a difference of function between the sequences, and we're pushing the assumption that because they're homologous that we have some kind of a clock-like situation beyond its limits, really.
The regular step, regressive alignment, when you align new sequence to a bunch of sequences already processed, so you have already multiple alignment for n minus one sequences, right? So the question is, do you do n minus one alignments with new one to everyone else, and then the best one you consider like what will guide you make multiple alignment of full n sequences? Another thing.
Most programs don't do all the possible alignments of the subtrees. There's some, for instance, Russ Doolittle's program that will try several alternates. I don't think there's any programs that exhaustively try alternative alignments. Is that the question?
Yeah, basically the question is how you do alignment of one sequence to n minus one sequence.
So the practical solution has been to do it by freezing those n minus one sequences in some pre-aligned state. Then you just have something that's analogous to doing a pairwise alignment. That's why progressive alignments are tractable. There's no reason you couldn't do a bigger multiple alignment, say of all the three sequence groups, because three sequence is a three-dimensional alignment. It's not that expensive. Another option, which is something that Jotunheim came up with in his thesis, which is back more than 15 years ago, close to 20 years ago maybe, was that one thing you can do is you can look at the alignments and you can look at the positions, the places in the pairwise alignments where, in fact, the alignment isn't very good, where it's ambiguous. Basically, leave those out until you move further up in the tree and have enough information to resolve the correct alignment. That's a very clever idea. He never implemented it for proteins, as far as I know. Yeah?
Yeah, but Kevin, I think there will be situations like actually you have a tree growing this way, tree growing this way, branches, joins, so you need to do a comparison, say, 5 sequences against 10 sequences.
Right.
So again, you still use your after profile to align them? Or
so you'd have those two sets of counts of residues, the two profiles. And then you have the pairwise distances, and you look at all the pairs between the two groups and come up with an average score.
Appropriate frequencies appear in the profile. So you weigh the score accordingly.
Right. Okay. All right, let me make a few comments about pileup. You actually see a number of publications, people use this program. They will make large trees, large multiple alignments, and they'll use these clustering diagrams, which aren't supposed to be really real phylogenetic trees, as if they were real phylogenetic trees. The distance that pileup uses and the alignments that it makes are global alignments. That's fine so long as all your sequences are about the same length. But when your sequences are very different in length, it causes some major problems. The errors that you get early on in alignment propagate through the alignment. That's a general problem with progressive alignments. And then I mentioned the last point. Now let's look at a more sophisticated method. Okay, this is the Clustal W method, which is something Des Higgins originally came up with. It must have been back in around 1988 or so, but there's been multiple different versions. There was a Clustal, I think 1, 2, and 3, and then they made an X Windows version, so there was Clustal X, and that's how Clustal W came in, I think. I'm not quite sure. Actually, I think there was Clustal Roman number 1, 2, 3, 4. 5, V, and then the next one was W. Then there was Clustal X, so something funny is going on. But Clustal W is a program that succeeds because it embeds a huge number of heuristics about alignments into this general procedure. And it works pretty well. It works. It's pretty robust to having a lot of different sequences that have different lengths. It's not robust to throwing in sequences that are totally unrelated. That will generally screw things up pretty well. So let me go through a few of the things it does. It uses a tree building method to make the guide tree called neighbor joining. Neighbor joining is one of the methods, the phylogenetic methods that regularly competes for the possible best method. The way neighbor joining works is it starts with some kind of a assumed tree like this, and it tries to ask the question, which two taxa can I pick out of that tree and put together so that I go from a tree that looks like this to one that looks like that, and have minimized the distances simultaneously within this group and this group. Okay, so what's the best choice of two things that look most like each other that don't somehow leave a bad group behind? Okay, we can make that a little more clear in a second. Okay, it's similar to a method that Walter Fitch originally developed for correctly getting branch lengths on UPGMA trees. It's a method that has no criterion function per se. It just has a rule for constructing the tree. That rule determines the tree you get. There's no way you can take that rule and apply it to another tree and say this is a better or worse tree by the neighbor joining criterion. Okay, so this is what you do. To make this tree, you have to minimize this function S, which is composed of the different distances. So this dij is all the distances between all the taxa in this square matrix. This is the sum of that over all the possible taxa. So dij, the distance between the two taxa we're considering joining. Distance over all the taxa minus the distances to taxon 1 that we're considering joining, minus all the sum of the distances to taxon 2 that we're considering joining, or taxon I and taxon J. Okay. Divided by a scaling factor that takes into account the number of nodes in that, in the diagram. Okay. Based on that, you can choose hierarchically the best two nodes to put together. Once you put them together, you essentially can average their distances. You make another choice. This is a better way of doing it than UPGMA. As if, let me just make a tree. Anytime I'm choosing which two things to combine in the UPGMA method, I'm never looking at more than two taxa. I'm just finding the smallest distance between any two taxa. What neighbor joining is doing is it's looking at all the distances that could contribute to your measurement. So in addition to this distance here, okay, there's other information on how long these branches are. So this distance here gives us some information on how long that branch is. The distance from this taxon to this one gives us information about how long this branch is. Okay. Neighbor joining basically sums all that information up to try to pick the two taxa that you could put together. Okay. This is equivalent to this Fitch and Margoliouth method for determining branch lengths in a tree.
More than one tail, it minimizes.
How do you get the overall tree?
No, how do you get, there's not one sequence.
After you've chosen the two that go together, then you treat them as a group and you calculate the distance. You basically average. So now you have the distance from this joined taxon to everyone else.
It's like your previous example. You can have more than one combination that gives you the minimum. In your, like the one you have on the board.
I don't think this method is guaranteed to give you the tree that has the shortest length.
Well, you don't want the tree that gives you the shortest.
You would like to have some criterion function that you could minimize, but this method isn't guaranteed to give it to you. Because it's again, a greedy method.
Yeah. Then the typo or I should be stuck over J, probably.
Yeah. Yes. Some of the
these here?
No.
Yeah, if you want to, you say that's RI and RJ, or you can just change the meaning of what the RIs and RJs are. I suspect I copied this out of an article. I may or may not be responsible for changing the subscripts. It may be that's the conventional way they do it. I can't remember. Okay. All right, so ClustLW does a progressive alignment. It builds the guide tree according to that neighbor joining method. Doing these pairwise alignments at each step and using, one of the things it does is it uses a variety of modified distances to create the guide tree to start with. So we know that evolutionary distances aren't linear. Okay, because of repetitive substitution at the same sites, that as time goes on, they become increasingly unlinear, and in fact, they plateau at a certain level of difference at a certain point. So that in fact, if you want to know, if you plot the number of substitutions versus the real distance, you get some plot like that, and you have to interpolate on that curve to come up with the actual distance. Okay, Clustel does that. As your tree grows and you move up this tree, it modifies the scoring table that it's using, for instance, a PAM scoring table, so that the scoring table you're using to combine these two taxa is not the same as the one you use when you combine 1 and 4 with 3, because they're more distant. Okay, that makes a lot of good sense. Clustel W uses position-specific gap penalties. And let me look at that on the next slide. Okay, it's well known in proteins that gaps don't occur in random positions. Okay, we know that they have a tendency to occur on these surface loops where you're unconstrained for insertion and deletion, as opposed to occurring in the core of the protein where you're likely to disrupt the structure. We also know that once you've started doing an alignment, and you've done several alignments, and you see where there's gaps, that's giving you additional information that says this is likely to be an unconstrained position in our sequences. We should be more willing to put gaps there than in any other place, probably a core region in the sequence. So, in fact, that's what happens here. There's a decrease in the gap penalties for putting in gaps close to gaps that are already there. Okay. There's an increase in the penalty just outside the gap region, so that if you're going to put in a gap and it just without any position-specific effect would fall close to the current gap but not on it, it'll get forced over onto the current gap instead of starting a new one. That seems to be biologically reasonable. Residues that are known to be found on the surface of the hydrophilic residues, aspartic acid, glutamic acid, glycine, lysine, asparagine, glutamine, proline, arginine, and serine, give you a reason to have, to assume there would be an easier, it would be easier to put in gaps there. So when there's runs of 5 or more of these, they decrease the gap penalty by a factor of 3. And then depending on, you can look through real alignments and tabulate frequencies of different alignments next to gaps. And then so there's a individual residue propensity for gaps that they also factor in. So basically, as you go across any alignment, the two sequences in any alignment, you have a varying, constantly varying gap penalty in Clustel. Well, I think this is a critical problem because people very seldom give you an explicit criterion function for what a better alignment is. There's a number of people who are creating what they call databases of expert alignments. Okay, so in that case, they're saying the goal is to make an alignment like the one the human would do. Now the problem is, I'll guarantee you set any two human experts down with a set of sequences, they're not going to give you the same alignments. That's a very hard target to hit. I think, and we'll talk about one, I'll talk about this in a minute. Well, so what do you mean?
You know the structure of these.
So an alignment is a correct alignment if it minimizes the RMS difference between the structure, two structures. That's a possibility. RMS difference is something crystallographers like, but it tends to be dominated by small differences in the most different parts. So it's not probably not the best. Another thing happens in structures that if you have, say you have some structure like that, two alpha helices with some kind of a loop. And I get an insertion that happens, say, right here, close to the end of that loop. Okay, so it maybe basically disorganizes this end of it. There's, to some extent, a restoring force. If that's a functionally important thing, there'll be a potent restoring force for these residues to mutate back towards the residues that were here first. And then when you look at the alignment, if you look at the structural alignment, it says, yes, we've still got an alpha helix here. These residues are equivalent. But really, they're the residues that used to be up here. And there's, in both the sequence and the structure, there's been a selection to make them go back towards what they were, to get that alpha helix back. And I think you see that quite a bit. It's very common when you look at structural alignments that you see some segment of structure, and you'll have whatever the sequences are. And then in the middle of the loop between them, there'll be a couple things conserved down a multiple alignment. And it's almost assuredly, I think, this kind of effect that's going on. There's actually a very strong selection at this point for residues that are hydrophilic and stick out in the solvent. Another kind of function that would be a good function, I think, to optimize and would be nice and explicit would be to optimize the sum of the information contents along the columns of the alignment. I don't see any reason why you couldn't use that. I think that would be a pretty good function. But as far as I know, nobody's used that.
That's what's used in DNA
modeling. Yeah.
Aside from the tendency to create nice patterns where you minimize the amount of change at every location, is there a phylogenetically based reason why the information content would be used?
Well,
more heuristic.
It's the assumption would then be that that's the biologically important pattern, that if you, to the extent that you can maximize all of these row similarities. Okay, the problem, one of the problems is there's a very complicated set of interrelationships between the 20 different amino acid residues. Some are more like one another than others. And I don't know how to calculate an information content weighted by that pairwise similarity. So in fact, some changes don't mean very much. A change of a D to an E, aspartic acid to glutamic acid, is the addition of one methylene group in the side chain. It's still an acidic residue. It's still relatively large, has very similar chemical properties. Okay, on the other hand, the change of a, say, a D to an S, aspartate to a serine, is a much more significant change. It's about the same size, but now you have a hydroxyl group instead of a polar carboxylic acid group. And then the change of, serine to an alanine, where you just take off the carboxyl or the hydroxyl group, not a huge change in size, but enormous difference in properties because you've gone from a hydroxyl group to an aliphatic methyl group. So,
you don't insist that it preserve everything or even make a judgment about what should be preserved. You just start trying to preserve as many of these properties as possible. I guess there was a good
that. There's a number of things that are like that. In fact, most profile methods really amount to that. That really what you're trying to do is deduce a property. And this is what the Dirichlet-Prior and Hibmarkov models basically does, is it allows you to select blindly and not knowing a property that is important at a position based on the residues that you observe. They're not. You could do that. That's, again, adds another layer of complexity. I think it would be true that if I showed you two alignments and one had more columns that aligned residues that were discernibly similar, say chemically similar, than the other, you'd probably pick the one that had more of those columns. So that's why I say something like a sum of information content would be better.
I think Pauline had a line about how what is important to us in terms of physicochemical properties is not necessarily what proteins consider.
In fact, I think that's still true. I mean, people who design molecules and try to think in advance and say, this molecule will be more active if I just change this serine to an aspartic acid, so far don't have that high a success rate there. I think if they get 50%, they're doing pretty well. Usually when they do those kinds of constructions, they'll just create all 20 changes if they can, and they just see which one is better. That's more efficient than figuring it out. You're probably closer to people who are actually trying to do that than I am these days. I don't have that much contact now. Okay. There's lots of methods out there for multiple alignment. I would say Clostal W pretty much dominates the market, partly because it's easy to use. It uses heuristics that biologists understand, and it gives them results that make sense to them. It has a reasonably rigorous guide tree method underlying it, and in fact, it's very easy in Clostal W to make the alignment and then go back and make a tree from the alignment so that you get an improved tree over the guide tree. That's a real phylogenetic tree that you can use in your paper. Nevertheless, we find that they're never good enough for us to work with, and we always have to go in and manually edit these alignments. And if you're thinking of working on a computer screen where you have 200 molecules, one per line, so it scrolls downward off the screen, and your molecules are each 600 or 700 residues long, so it scrolls to the right off the screen, editing that is a big problem. It's a big pain, and it takes a huge amount of time for us. And there's some other approaches to dealing with that people have tried, and in particular, there was this program called SAGA, Sequence Alignment by Genetic Algorithm, which I think is a attractive way to go. It's been superseded by something called T-Coffee. But this was the original paper. Did I put the T-Coffee reference on the other page? Yeah, I put that on the other page. In both of these, so why are the alignments bad? The alignments are bad and looking at them, I think primarily because you get local alignments between pairs of sequences that are incorrect, and these incorrect sub-alignments that propagate to the whole alignment, and it just ends up being incorrect. A common objective function people have used is this sum of pairs criterion that MSA, multiple sequence alignment, Betsy Volschel's n-dimensional alignment program used originally. Again, that has the problem in that it's originally Steve used to say that method assumes no tree, but it's not true. It assumes a particular kind of tree, which is a star tree where nobody has any hierarchical relationship. An explicit function that measured the quality of multiple alignment as being that which produces the minimum length tree, I think would make enormously good sense. There's no way, I think, to get at that explicitly, but with some kind of simulated annealing algorithm, you can easily imagine making an alignment, say, by Clostal W, and then doing some sort of local operations on it that would minimize the length of the tree that you would build based on that alignment. And that, I think, is a pretty attractive idea. Des Higgins and his collaborators proposed this coffee score as a criterion function. That basically says the correct multiple alignment is the one that's consistent at the most positions with all the pairwise alignments. Okay, so in a sense, the multiple alignment that minimizes the difference from the sum of the pairwise alignments. Okay, and they calculate that and as the sum of the scores for that. You can take each pairwise alignment out of the multiple alignment, calculate a pair score for that, normalize it for length. Okay, I mentioned these other two methods. That's one I think is a good possibility for, and then the shortest tree method. It's surprising, considering how much effort people put into this and how the kinds of conclusions they draw to it, that people have been so slow to come up with explicit definitions for the function they're trying to optimize in doing alignments. And part of it has just been resistance from the people who stare at alignments by hand and aren't willing to believe that any program could possibly make an alignment that's as good as they are. Mostly moving things around near to existing insertions and deletions. So usually it's local changes near the boundaries of places where the alignment algorithm has put in insertions and deletions.
Yeah, I've always been confused about that because it seems like if the person is doing it by manually, there must be some type of implicit scoring function that that person is using.
That's right.
So the question is, why can't that be put into these methods?
And so
that is more accurate than
I mean that's why I say personally I like this information content idea, because I do this a lot, and I think that's what I'm doing when I do it, is I'm basically trying to come up with an alignment that has more rows that show a high information content. And then if I have two different alignments, one that has more rows that are highly conserved versus one that doesn't, I think I can tell that the one that has more of these highly conserved rows is better. So this suits my qualitative opinion.
Well, you really need a double-blind test or something like that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, really.
But the question is, what's your gold standard? What is the correct data that you're going to test people against? Is it Russ Doolittle's alignments or mine or? They'll resemble each other. They won't be identically the same. Partly, one of the reasons they're not the same is a trivial reason, that there's a huge amount of detail, okay, and that the editing programs people have available don't do anything like show you a running criterion function so you know when you're going away from an optimal solution. Those, I think, are trivial. I would like to say that if you took two people who had lots of experience with sequence alignments and gave them the same problem as opposed to, say, me and my graduate student, that the two people with lots of experience would give you more similar alignments. So that there actually is an expertise involved here. But I would hate to put money on that, I think. I think the answer is yes. One of the things you have to keep in mind is the parts that people will unambiguously agree on are the conserved parts. The conserved parts are essentially the parts that are moving with a very slow clock. Those, a very slow clock rate, they're evolving very slowly. Those those parts of a sequence will tend to give you lots of information about the deep nodes in the tree, the nodes close to the root of the tree, and they'll give you no information about the leaf nodes, because all the leaf nodes are identical between any closer related pair. There's change isn't fast enough. So there's a very interesting effect that the highly variable regions, the regions that are changing quickly, give you lots of information about the leaf nodes of the tree. They give you very little information about the deep nodes, because by the time you look at sequences that are very distant from each other, they've been effectively randomized versus each other, and they're just giving you noise. These slowly changing methods don't tell you anything about how closely related sequences relate, because they're just identical, but they tell you how distantly related sequences relate. How to factor that into a tree, I don't know.
I have a proposed experiment. Take a set of, that I think that there is a way of judging whether the alignment is better or worse based upon likelihood criteria. That is, in other words, you take a set of aligned sequences, you construct a tree based upon those aligned sequences using some type of model and look at the log likelihood scores, and use that to, but you don't have the problem of sampling if you have a fixed alignment. So if you were to take some alignments generated by these various methods, including hand-edited alignments, give them to a phylogenetic program, construct a tree and look at the log likelihood scores, then that might give you an idea of, does hand-editing improve the alignment? If it does, what type of hand-editing is doing?
So people do this all the time in systematics. They generate synthetic sequences according to a tree of their choosing, or some random stochastic tree. Some model of evolution, and almost invariably they come up with a set of sequences that supports their method of building the tree. Why is that? Well, it's not because trivially because they're cheating, it's because they have their tree method comes from their ideas of what's important in evolution. Their ideas of what is important in evolution goes into their method of generating a sample set of ideal sequences. So it's hard. I think it's hard to break out of that.
I was kind of suggesting you do real data. In other words, you took a set of cytochromes or a set of.
So there are some sets of data, and I can't honestly say whether I agree that they're well aligned or not, that people have been putting on the internet that are supposedly expert alignments.
But I'm saying that what you do is you take an ensemble alignment and you ask the question, if you build it into a phylogenetic tree, optimal phylogenetic tree, using some type of model for the way sequences change, you could then look at the likelihood scores of that tree given that particular alignment and use that to assay which alignments are better or worse.
So that would be like this one I'm saying here, the shortest tree or the most likely. The highest likelihood tree.
Right.
The best alignment is the one that generates a best tree with the highest likelihood. I think that's a very justifiable criterion, but it demands that you solve this simultaneously tree and alignment problem.
Well, what I'm thinking is there's just an assay of asking the question, does hand editing help?
Yeah.
Or does, or
Terry?
Well, I don't know if you want to hear from Mark. So, is this the biggest problem with my ability to handle that? Your model doesn't capture what's going on, then you have no idea that there's not much magic. And that's why, and if there was, it was wrong. Given no model, you want to see what the probability you get is kind of a result by chance. And maybe the problem here is that you just know where the lab is and the district of the
isn't there actually real good data? I mean, so you can compare, an evolutionary model and substitutions and stuff, the tree. Are there people like Skardensky at Michigan State who actually have something ridiculous like 30,000 generations of bacteria involving some for certain functions, some of them involving randomly and whatnot? And he actually freezes them every like 2,000 generations, and so in some sense are keeping the ancestors further than ever. And then you actually have real data. I mean, more
yeah, there's not that much of that, but that's some really interesting and important data. which I haven't actually looked at, but probably I should. But there's not, it's not easy. That's a painful experiment to do. But.
Yes, I thought the DIJ you first constructed, like for the last tile, you say, well, along the path, when you sort of go from one level to the other level, to the scoring point kind of changes the alignment. But when we first decide the DIJ, you just use a uniform scoring point, right?
For the first, pass, yeah. And then you interpolate from that onto this curve. I put the number of identical residues here, but this could be a score by a single scoring table. And so it allows you to interpolate from that onto a curve of real distance, and then you can get a modified scoring table.
Well, I'm trying to ask you the sensitivity to that initial scoring function, because
it's a good question. I don't really know the answer. I think it's probably relatively insensitive to that, but that's just an opinion. There's so many parameters that you can modify, so many heuristics built into ClustLW, I don't think it's ever been exhaustively tested in all combinations. Right, so ClustLW is probably the best on the market, unless you want to maybe do Saga or tea and coffee on it afterwards to try to modify. And we're actually running some experiments right now with both Saga and tea and coffee compared to hand edited alignments to see are they adequate to replace at least some part of hand editing. From that starting alignment, it's quite common now then to go one or two different directions, several different directions, through using these multiple sequence methods called profile analysis or hidden Markov models. And those are basically what I would call leader-follower, master-slave alignments. Okay, so you get some multiple alignment, you use that to make a profile or some summary of the probability distributions down each column. Then you take that and align all the sequences back to that, and then you can iterate through that process, and it actually helps you to iterate through that process a limited number of times. Okay, so that's quite similar to PsyBlast, except that you're using a fixed set of sequences, it's not increasing at each stage. So that was the next thing I wanted to go into, and looks like we're rapidly running out of time, so something's not going to get talked about here. All right, so let me again go through the rationale. Okay, so we're looking at some kind of a protein structure. But what we have in our hand is something like this. Okay, now this happens to be out of that structure. This is precisely the sequence that forms that EF hand sequence, the alpha helix, the loop that binds the calcium, and the second alpha helix. But based on this, it's pretty hard to tell me anything interesting about that sequence. But the multiple sequence alignment tells us quite a bit because it has these patterns of conserved residues. And so making some sort of a probabilistic description where we look at the probabilities down these columns, we look at which ones are conserved in a particular character, should give us some kind of a template that we can align these sequences to that's better than doing these pairwise ones. Because the places where things vary, let's see, here's a good one where they vary. There's a couple of phenylalanines, which are flat aromatic groups, a couple of glutamic acids, which are acidic groups. Valine is hydrophobic, arginine is basic and very big, again, small and hydrophobic, and couple of hydrophilic medium-sized residues. Okay, a lot of diversity there. What does that tell us? That tells us, in fact, that the protein structure probably doesn't much care what goes there. The sequences are free to accept any mutation that occurs at random. So, in fact, this is a don't care position. A position like this, where everything is G, this is shouting at us, I gotta have a G here. Okay, so we just capture that as some kind of probabilistic description. Here's a little more complicated view of an alignment where things are color-coded more or less by chemistry, and you can see the kind of variation you get from places that are completely conserved, like some of these over here, to places that are very close to random at a number of these positions, especially as we get down here. I'm not saying this is a perfect alignment. Okay, so I'm going to talk briefly first about what we call profiles, then I'll talk briefly about hidden Markov models. I think there's a lot of literature on both of these, so I'll try to stay brief. So we know when we look at proteins, we have certain kinds of patterns. We have patterns of conserved and variable regions. We have insertions and deletions, which are important. We know that we have a modular kind of system in that modules from one protein will occur in another protein in a context maybe that's completely different. So you might have something like a protein interacting region that occurs with, say, a protein kinase catalytic region, or maybe occurs with an enzymatic kind of catalytic region. And its only purpose is there is it's a module that allows proteins to interact. Okay, so we want to use a dynamic programming method so we can have insertions and deletions. We use a local homology method so that we can find these modules that are embedded in a lot of noise. Okay, so you can even use suboptimal non-intersecting alignments. Did Steve talk about those at all? I'm not going to talk about those. One of the problems, let me just mention, one of the problems with dynamic programming is it gives you the most probable alignment, the highest scoring alignment. There's ways to get out of that same system alignments that are not as good as the best one. Okay? And because of the difference between the biological reality and the mathematical model, those not quite the best solutions may in fact be the correct biological ones. So it's often interesting to look at these suboptimal alignments. Okay, so let me just give you quickly the idea behind a profile, which I think you all understand, and I think Steve has talked about probably. This is the way I usually look at a dynamic programming operation, which I think is different than what Steve showed you. I've got the sequences going up here and over here, so this is zero in the corner. Somehow I learned that in school, I guess. At any point in this alignment, say if we're looking at this cell where we're comparing a T, which could be a threonine, to a C, which could be a cysteine, we look up the score for the T and C in our scoring table. We add that score onto the best previous alignment we could have got, which has to be in this either this row or this column, plus any gap penalty. Say if we go from here to here, we have to pay a penalty for skipping across those two. Okay. So that's an n-squared algorithm that considers all possible gaps, all possible numbers of gaps of all possible sizes in all possible positions, which I think is pretty phenomenal. Okay, the profile case is virtually not different. There's no difference in complexity. And all you're doing here then is you have a set of sequences that you've somehow fixed with respect to each other. These could be counts here, they could be just scores. Okay, at this position, okay, say we're looking at a set of sequences, it looks like they only had a T here. We're comparing that position, which a position in multiple alignment, to one new sequence. We look up the score for this cell by looking in the C column of this matrix. Okay, so how well does a C score against the residues we already have aligned and fixed. Okay. That same score gets added onto the best previous alignment with gap penalties in precisely the same way. So there's virtually no difference there. The trick is really coming up with the values in this matrix. Okay. Obviously, straight counts don't make any sense, because we know there's this hierarchical relationship, and you have to do something better. So the way I like to think about it then is a profile is a model of all the sequences it could match to a given sequence or a structural motif. I seem to have trouble staying on the board. Okay, so in principle, you might think a log odds score, just looking at the frequencies in a column, might be the best kind of statistic to use. I'm going to argue that it's not for a couple of reasons. One is, because we have a limited number of sequences, we don't have a very big sample often. That sample is very biased. There's particular organisms that people like to sequence even now, so you get a non-representative sample. Sometimes we have additional information as well that you'd like to throw in. You may know, for instance, that the reason why this D is absolutely conserved in the sequence is because it's the active site residue in this enzyme, and it has a catalytic function that you can't do without. Okay? In that case, some kind of a log odds score will probably underestimate the importance of such a residue. And then the bigger problem is what we're relying on is homology. We're relying on this idea that the molecules have more or less recently diverged. Okay, so in their recent history, they had identical structure and identical function, and that they've, by virtue of that ancestry, retained that similar function. So what we're really looking at is the functional constraint. In real life, as soon as the molecules diverge in sequence, they start to diverge slightly in function, and if they're duplicated and selected for some different function, that can happen rather rapidly. At some point, the changes in the sequence affect the structure, and you, if you will, move from one different optimal plateau protein structure to a different one. And at that point, at least regions of the molecule, this homology concept are really broken. They're no longer trying to, if you will, look the same. So the alternative, and the alternative that both, I think, hidden Markov models and profiles use, is to try to use some biological model instead of these frequencies, to use the observed frequencies to choose from some biologically relevant model, an ideal kind of situation. Okay, so what we do for the profiles is we use the PAM model of evolution. Okay, so this idea of if you can define the 1% different step of evolution, that longer steps of evolution are just a series of those steps as some kind of a Markov process. We take a bunch of different PAM distances. We generate tables at intervals of powers of 2, so from PAM distance 2 up to 1024. For each possible ancestral residue, then you have a vector of probability that that ancestral residue will have changed the 20 other residues. We take those, we call them residue frequency distributions, and compare them to what we observed in a particular column of the multiple alignment. One of the problems you have is these distributions, these residue frequency distributions for different distances are highly correlated. So obviously if I go from a PAM distance of 2 to a PAM distance of 4 to a PAM distance of 8, those vectors all look very similar and they only change gradually. So you want to just pick one. We pick the one that optimizes the cross entropy between the ideal and the observed ones. So we end up with 20 of these distributions, and then we weight them according to the probability that they would generate the observed data. Okay, that gives us a kind of a mixture model. We convert that into log odds scores that go in the into the profiles. So what that amounts to is saying we're going to select out of a reasonably large set of biologically relevant models, these PAM Dethoff models. So we have 220 sets of residue frequency distributions. We're going to choose the three or four that most look like this position, and we're going to combine them weighted on the probability they explain what we observe. And you get something like this for several different positions. So this first position, you can see, is mostly A's. It's got a few other things, a V, a T. Okay. The model that comes out of that, this is, it says A here, is with a weight of 0.6 and a PAM distance of 1, that is A absolutely conserved, plus small mixtures of models for T and S at more divergent distances. If you look at a more a position that varies more, which I suppose would be like this one, where you have 4 alanines, threonine, leucine, threonines, valines, alanine, leucine, leucine, valine, valine, threonine, valine, you get a much more mixed model. Okay, so this says substantial at mixtures of a valine ancestor, isoleucine, threonine, alanine, methionine, etc. Notice that the second biggest component is this isoleucine ancestral component. There's no isoleucines at all in that column. However, based on both what we know about biology and what we know about the PAM model of evolution, given all the hydrophobic residues you see in that column, you'd actually expect to see a fair number of isoleucines if you look at a bigger sampling of proteins. Okay, so let me just give you a brief example of this in use. Here's an example of a blast search. This is a blast search done with an E. coli protein called FecI. FecI is a protein involved in iron utilization. It turns on, it's an activator for a suite of genes. Okay, it turns out the way RNA polymerase works in bacteria is there's specificity modules that come in to turn on different suites of genes. This is one such specificity module. So it's vaguely like the other ones, but in particular mostly like itself. And so you can see this is FecI. It's called a sigma subunit. It's related to some of these other things. And the E values drop off pretty quickly. Okay, these are all the E values that are less than 10 to the minus 5, which is a kind of a typical heuristic cutoff for close relatives or even pretty distant relatives. And if you look further down this list of blast scores, you can find a number of additional things. Oh, this gets better. Oh, my eyes are so bad I can't tell when it's in focus. So the ones I marked in green here are ones that I know, in fact, are sigma factors. The ones I marked in red are ones that I don't think are probably sigma factors. And so you can see, before you get very far down the list, even at p-values of 10 to the minus 4, you're finding things that probably aren't real positive hits. And then these black ones, again, are true positives. The green, I thought, are probable positives. Okay, so unambiguously, we find what? Then about 15 or so matches to the sequence. We know that's wrong. Okay, I know that in the database of sigma factors, there's a couple of hundred sigma factors that should be coming up. Some of them are just way down the list. And in fact, most of them, probably down to this point, we've only seen about 30 or so of them. So there must be hundreds down beyond this point with these must be p-values, not e-values. P-values are very close to 1. Okay, so if we take the set of sequences that I showed on the first page, which are the closest relatives, generate some kind of a multiple sequence alignment, and then construct the profile from that, and then do the same kind of search. We take the profile search through the database. You get a much different story. And this is a kind of an old output, so now the output comes out in terms of E values, but right, this was Z scores. These are all The top scores, these are all sigma factors. And it goes on to another page. Those are all sigma factors. In fact, we find probably better than 90% of all the sigma factors before we find one that's not. Okay, so adding this additional information from the multiple alignment cleans things up a lot. It works great for a psi blast. It works great for profiles. And the same principle is applying, which is that one of the biggest problems you have in database searching is not the things that match, but the noise from the things that don't match. Okay, because it doesn't matter what you do to your probe, your query, you're not going to raise the score for the things that match very much. But almost all the things you do, like lowering gap penalties and things like that, increase the score for the things that don't match. What using these multiple sequence methods seems to do is to decrease these spurious matches to the things that don't match more than increasing the matches to the things that do match. Now, the other thing one can use this for, and that we actually use it for, is to take our alignments generated by ClustalW without hand editing them. We create the profile, then we go back and align all the sequences we started with back to that profile. And that cleans up a lot of the little variation, especially variations around gaps, that was introduced by the fact that the pairwise alignments chose slightly different alignments at some early stage in different subtrees of the overall tree. And that substantially reduces our need for hand editing, but not completely. Some of those alignments are almost as good as hand edited ones, but not quite. Okay, so let me show you this before we go on. This is a kind of a diagram for a finite state machine that would describe how a profile works. Okay. You have a description of what the here are called match states. So these would be the aligned positions in the different columns of the multiple alignment. Each one of these boxes has some probability distribution that describes the residues that could match, or probability or log odds or something related to probability. In between those, at any place, you can have insertions, okay, with some probability. You can have deletions that skip, say, from this column. We don't have this column, we skip across to this column. Maybe we skip both of those and go directly to the end. Okay. This is basically the same diagram that you'll use for a hidden Markov model. In hidden Markov models, these things are usually explicitly probabilities and not log odds. The only difference really in the profile model is that there's a tie made between the probabilities of going into an insert state and the probability of going into a delete state. That was actually something that we added originally. Originally, those were independent, so they would have been the same. I'm not sure if there's a good justification for that. My original justification was that we generally didn't have enough data to justify an independent model for insertions and deletions. But I could be persuaded. So this is a method that's trying to look at a set of observed sequences and come up with some kind of a consensus model for a family. It's obviously very important how you select your data, whether your data is a biased or unbiased sample. If you have a biased sample, which is almost always true, you need to apply some kind of a weighting so that you can think of a very trivial case where you have five identical sequences and one sequence that's different. You want that to come out 50% between the five identical ones and the different one, not 80% like the five identical ones. There's lots of methods out there to do that. If somebody wants references to that, I put in a few slides which will be in or gets posted, but I think I'm going to skip past it for now unless somebody's dying to talk about that. It turns out it makes a big difference in how well things work, but the precise method that you use to weight the sequences doesn't seem to make a very big difference, so long as it does some rough accounting for redundancy in the data. Okay, so let me speak briefly about hidden Markov models. And I see I'm already over time, right? I only have an hour or more of slides to go. Are you going to have somebody come in and talk explicitly about hidden Markov models?
Yeah, well, in the beginning of March, we'll have a meeting and tomorrow.
All right, so let me say something not very much about these, because I guess you're going to cover some of this tomorrow? Okay, so there's some references here. Hidden Markov models in a lot of ways provide a theoretical underpinning that explains why the profile approach works. And if we'd known about hidden Markov models, I guess we probably would have been the first to use those, but we didn't. There's a very good book on this, or I think it's a good book, this book by Durbin et al. On biological sequence analysis. It's what we actually use for our course. They present a general treatment of a lot of processes from a hidden Markov model perspective. And that is an excellent place to start. These are called hidden Markov models because there's not a one-to-one correspondence between the number of states in the model and the symbols. If you have a model like this, each one of these states, these pink states, you could think of as being a state that emits a symbol probabilistically. Okay, it can emit any of the 20 amino acid symbols. So the same for that one, same for that one, with different probabilities. So when you look at a string that was emitted by this machine, you can't tell explicitly that a given residue came from some particular state. You can estimate what the most likely state was. Hidden Markov models are implemented as a learning algorithm. Okay, so you train a model based on a training set of sequences. That model is often preloaded using a progressive multiple alignment to define the number of states in the model. So again, we get back to ClustLW as a core method. Then basically, you take your training set of sequences, you align each one of those training set of sequences to the model, and you update the probabilities in each state based on that alignment. And this is done using the maximum, or the total probability alignment, not a maximum probability alignment. Okay, so you're going to talk about some of this tomorrow?
In a little bit different aspect.
Yeah. Okay, so in addition to the maximum probability alignments that we do, where when you look through this matrix and you find the best previous alignment, okay, that's maximizing probability by finding the highest probability. Okay, you can do it another way. You can sum across all those previous alignments and come up with the total probability for all different kinds, paths of alignments to get to the cell you're at. Okay, so that's this other approach, this Baum-Welch approach. You have to come up with two things, these emission probabilities and the transition probabilities. The transition probabilities, to show another view here. This is again the same, this is the same machine as before, just presented in a different way. You have your match states, you can go into an insert state, or you can skip by going through a delete state. So you have to learn these probabilities inside the match states, the emission probabilities for the residues. You have to learn the probabilities of going from each match state to an insert or a delete state. Those are all trained iteratively on this training set.
Michael, maybe since it's getting so late, could you give us a 5-minute idea of what
progressive would be when we make a break, and then the afternoon?
What I was going to suggest is I finish with the hidden Markov models, and I'll tell you what else I could have talked about. That's up to, I'm here all day, it's up to you guys. If you can stand it, I can do it. So. So I was just going to say just a probably 5 minutes more. And then for the rest of what I have to talk about are local methods, and that mostly, let's see, what do I have? Mostly that has to do with EM and Gibbs sampling to find local motifs, which I think are two algorithms we ought to be looking at for the future. And then hidden Markov models will take me just a few minutes, so I'm not going to say a huge amount.
Let's finish those, and then if it's interesting.
Okay. So what's the general procedure? Usually, you align your training set of sequences. That's because it's very hard to decide without doing that on the right number of states for the model. And you get into this problem, you're trying to come up with a model that has the maximum probability of explaining the training data. If you have models with different numbers of parameters, it's very hard to decide which model is correct. So to make that easier and get close to start with a multiple alignment. All the columns that have significant more than 50% residues are set up as match states. So you choose this number of match and insert states. Apply some weighting to the sequences. This could be a tree-based weighting, so you downweight sequences that are essentially identical. Then you go through this training thing. And then when you're done, you can take that trained model, use it to induce a multiple alignment on your sequences as a leader-follower alignment. That is, you independently align each sequence to this model. That puts them into alignment with each other implicitly, so that's what makes it a leader-follower alignment. That's the same thing we would do with a profile to generate a multiple alignment. Okay. So in this training, you have to evaluate the total probability that each match state emits each possible residue. And you do that by aligning the each sequence to the current model and evaluating the total probabilities. Okay, and then you sum it over your whole training set to come up to re-estimate these. And this is a procedure that's very much like expectation maximization. Okay, so first you evaluate the probabilities of each match state emitting a certain residue, and then you generate a maximum likelihood model for that, and you iterate. And there's just something about the update function, and let me go past that. Okay. Then in the database search portion, you would typically use the maximum probability or Viterbi algorithm to get a single best score for each sequence in the database according to the model. So maximum probability that a sequence instance was generated from this model. Those can be presented as log odd scores or p-values. It's
why did you use the Viterbi at this point rather than the sum over possible lines?
It works better.
In terms of what?
It gives you a better discrimination of things you know are related.
So it's just a heuristic.
That's been the experience so far that I've seen. Have you heard other things, Ralph? I mean, people have debated, there has been some debate about this, but of the results I've seen, it looks like the maximum probability gives you a cleaner result. And that's probably, I think, because there's so much possible noise when you look at the total probability. It just, if your real goal is discrimination, it lets the negatives have too many chances to score well. Okay, there's two widely used packages out there. One's called Hammer, not Hummer, and the other one's called SAM. Those are both available on the internet. I think hammer is more widely used, by, especially by biologists. It's more of a, what I should say, it's a more user-friendly program. It does the things that the biologists want to do a little more easily than SAM does. So that's not a comment on the quality of the programs, it's a comment on how easy they are for people. All right, so what, I've sort of gone through this, I went through this last one really quickly now. I went through these three things. The last thing I have left to talk about is these local alignment methods, one of which is something that we work on, and especially Tim Bailey, who works with me, works on, called MEME, which uses the expectation maximization approach to find local highly conserved regions. Those can then be used as the, in one of these sort of leader-follower alignments to create local multiple alignments. And another approach that I have just a few slides on, it does a similar thing. It's called Gibbs sampling. I think those are both general and very flexible algorithms that perhaps we should be thinking of using more. If I had more time, I think we would do more with them, but I run out of time to do things myself. So, okay, so why don't we have a break, and then people can, I guess, vote whether they want to hear about those things. So a gene tree will always overestimate the time of divergence between organisms. So if you build species trees based on genes, you'll always overestimate when they diverge, because the genes always diverge before the species.
I heard about this one thing where they were hit.
Well, because even if you have a speciation event, each species typically only gets some subset of alleles. What are alleles? Alleles are genes that have already diverged to some extent.
I heard about this one thing where
how big a pole was that? How was it? What's the discovery?
I don't think anybody really knows. I mean, nobody really understands how speciation happens, I think. We think we sort of know in a hand-waving way how it happens, but I don't think anybody can quantify it.
Harry, you heard about this one study where they took something like 100 genes from these group of species, all orthologs, and they tried to see how many of the well-resolved phylogenies, and they tried to resolve how many of them share the same phylogeny. And I think it was something like 60% of them.
It's one of the really interesting things.
Didn't so assuming the 60% were the under best case were the species, means that 40% had gene trees that were not the same as the species tree.
So, but if you had a majority, right, it could be much less.
No, they're guessing that it's about the 60%, but it could be.
So, 10% had common phylogeny.
These included bacteria,
I don't know.
I think.
I think we should then,
Well, one of the things that we now know is that there seems to have been a lot more lateral gene transfer among bacteria than we thought just a few years ago. So, that is making the whole tree business very difficult. So, anyway, let me start. I wanted to say one more thing about hidden Markov models before I forgot. As you do this iterative training, you count for each state what the alignment is of the residues in the training set to get the set of probabilities for the next step. There's a regularization that happens at this step, so that there's a set of observed frequencies, and those are fit to a model of what expected biological frequencies are. Okay, and that's usually done using these Dirichlet priors, and I assume somebody's going to talk about those. But a model that was made by going through a large database of alignments, counting the looking at columns and looking at residue frequencies in columns, and making a model for that. So that's very much like what we do with the profiles. There's this strong regularization step. And I'll come back to that when I talk about MEME, if I don't forget, to talk about why that's important. Okay, so I wanted to talk about mostly about this method called MEME, but also about Gibbs sampler, which I think is a pretty interesting method, and it's used for a lot of the same things. a lot of this is what you could call local alignments. We focus on motifs. People often ask what motifs are, and what I'll say is it's a context-dependent definition. But the definition that comes out of the dictionary is pretty good, a recurrent thematic element. And when you look at proteins, you see this all the time, that there are modules of proteins that occur in many different proteins, some that are unrelated, often repeated within one protein. So we see those as repeated blocks of sequence with mutational change. And then in the structure, you see those as independently or semi-independently folding blocks of structure. Okay. When you look at a big sequence alignment, you also see a very prominent pattern of blocks that are conserved spaced by blocks where there's a lot of variability and or gaps. Okay. So that is usually what people mean when they say sequence motifs, and that's actually what we're going to talk about here. Blocks of conserved sequence that don't have gaps. Okay, so if you have some bunch of sequence like that, you can make some model of it. And this could be some kind of a weight matrix. This is, we like to call these now possums, which I thought Steve Hennikoff invented, but Steve said I invented it, so I don't know. But position-specific squaring matrices, and they just give, for each position along a sequence, for every possible character you could put there, some kind of a score. It could be, in this case, they're just percentages, but more likely to be log odds score of some kind. Okay. In this case, we're going to simplify our life because we're not going to allow insertions and deletions. So in fact, we only have to use an order n algorithm, not an order n squared algorithm to do this. There's lots of concerns that come into this. Log odds is good. What to put in the background of a log odds model is, I think, particularly ignored a lot of the time. People in working in proteins usually use an independent model where you just take the background composition of the proteins and use that as the expected. That's almost certainly not perfect, and it definitely doesn't work very well for DNA, where some higher order model, which I think you're going to hear about tomorrow, so I won't dwell on it, but maybe something like a fifth or a sixth order Markov model might be the right thing to use. On top of that, there's other things that come into it, whether or not you want to include the composition of the query sequence, whether you want to look at the local composition of your query or training sequences, or do some combination of the above, all make a big difference to your result. Okay. All right, so for the example we're going to have now, we're going to use a much simpler little model than the machine I showed you before. So here we have some idling state, and then we have a model that has just match states. Each one of these match states has some set of probabilities of emitting a set of residues. There's no possibility for skipping or anything.
So the question, for instance, with recognizing, I don't know, promoter regions or things like that, is this the idea that there are no insertions and deletions useful first approximation, or is it a very good, accurate description of phenomena?
So what the focus here is on the conserved blocks, and if you have variable spacing regions, what you can do, or what we will argue you can do, is you can just learn the two conserved blocks on either side of the variable region, and then just basically leave out the variable region. So there's something I'll come to at the end of, obviously, order and spacing of these motifs is important. There's both some advantages and some disadvantages to doing it this way. Okay. All right, so what I'm going to tell you about is a program called MEME, which I can never remember what the acronym is, but it has EM in it, which means expectation maximization. I think, I can't even remember the acronym. The cases I showed you before were cases where we used aligned sequences to find an unknown pattern. Okay, so even when in the hidden Markov models, we needed to do some preliminary alignment of the sequences. Okay, what I'm going to show you now are two methods where you use unaligned sequences and an unknown pattern. So you just take a bunch of sequences and you throw it at the method and say, show me some pattern that's significant in there. And all I'm going to tell you is some constraints. And the constraints generally is you have to have are the number of motifs and how wide they are. Okay. We're not going to allow gaps. Both the methods I'm going to show you are not guaranteed to be globally optimal, although they're probably as optimal as they need to be. And then we'll talk a little bit about these last issues. So, EM is a general optimization technique. It's a two-step iterative process. First, what we're going to do is take a training set of sequences. So we'll have some number of different sequences. We're going to look for a motif of a certain width. So given that certain width pattern, we can evaluate the probability along the length of each of these sequences in the training set, what the probability is that each of those positions is a site. Okay, given those probabilities, then we can recalculate the maximum likelihood estimation of the pattern, okay, basically by counting the residues at the sites weighted by their probabilities. And then we iterate, and this process will converge, and I'll show you a real example where it converges quickly.
What do you mean that each sequence position is a site? In what case would it not be a site?
All right, so let me show you the real example. So here's a very simple example. There's two sequences. We're going to look for a pattern that's three bases long. Okay, so this is a pattern we're going to learn. Here's one site in the first sequence. Okay, and then we can slide that over by one and have the next site. So there'll be a total of eight possible sites in each of those sequences. Okay, so I'm going to specifically try to learn here the most probable three-wide pattern so that there's one occurrence in each sequence. Okay. So this is my starting model. You might say that's an informationless model. I guess you might argue it was more informationless if I'd used exactly the frequencies that were in the sequences, but I think this is an easier demonstration that I don't know anything. I'm saying all bases are equally probable in all positions. And then I just have to go down these sequences and calculate the probability that each one of these sites would arise from this model. Okay, so I take the probability of T in the first position, 0.25, probability of A in each of the second two positions, 0.25, multiply it out and get, I think there's a decimal point error here, 0.0156. Okay, so that's the probability that this first position was generated by that model. Obviously, since they're all equally probable, as I go down these sequences, they're the same in all positions. This is the last site because it's the last one that has three. Okay. I sum these over the whole length of the sequence, they sum to 0.125. Well, I told you the model we were going to learn was that there was one site per sequence, so that probability has to sum to 1. So we just renormalize by dividing by 0.125 these probabilities that are 0.125 everywhere along the sequence. So that's the first E step. Now we're going to recalculate the pattern based on these probabilities. So let's look at, for instance, T in the first position. We need to count how many windows have T in the first position. Okay, so there's one here, TAA, there's one here. There's one here and one here. Okay, that's four. This one, that T can never be in the first position of the window.
HT is also in the middle.
Okay, so we're looking at T in the first position of windows.
Oh, in the first position. I see.
So there's that one. That pen doesn't work. Try a different one. There's that one. That one. That one. And that one. Okay, so there's four. So we count them weighted by their probability. So that's 0.125 times 4, and we come up with 0.5. Okay. Same for every other one. If we want to know A in the first position of the window, so there's one here, one here, one here, one here. So how many? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I hope 9 times 0.125 is 1.125. Okay? So very simple.
You've thrown out the information that there's one and only one per segment when you do this counting.
It's in there because the sum of the probabilities across each sequence is one. Now, if we had a different model, that there were, in fact, exactly two per segment, then we might want to do something different. Or we could have a model where there were two sites in this one and one in this one. It's very flexible.
Well, I'm just thinking that, for instance, the probability that in this shared model that there's a... Okay,
so once we do this for all the different letters and all the different positions, we come up with this table. You will notice, if you're a quick adder, that each of these columns sums to 2, as it must, because the probabilities across the sequences are 1 each. Okay, so we divide each column by 2 to make it back into a real probability table, and we get this. This is no longer an informationless pattern. In fact, you can see it already, after one cycle, has a prominent motif coming out of it. So that's this AAA. And that happens to be the only three long sequence that I loaded into these two sequences. So there's one there.
I think you are throwing out information in terms of the fact that there's one per sequence. In other words, imagine you had two strong patterns, both in A, absent in B, and a weaker pattern present once in A and once in B. It would find the stronger pattern that's doubly represented in the first sequence, and this, the weaker pattern that's present in both sequences.
It could, yeah. So if you wanted that to be your model, you'd have to put that into your model with the right probabilities being calculated.
Right, but just things that...
I don't know if you could do that particular one, but
I think you could.
But you can do a lot of very complicated things.
Right, in other words, what you could do is do something like the probability that is found in both sequences, or something like that, rather than maximizing the total probability that it's as frequent as possible.
In fact, this is not the best general model to use. For some practical reasons, which I'll come to after a while. So then we go through, that was an M step, now we're back to E. Okay, now we go through for each window and calculate again the probability. These are the numbers out of that probability table we just recalculated. So now the probability of TAA is 0.25 times 0.56 times 0.4, 0.06. And if we calculate these everywhere and then renormalize them, we come up with these numbers here. Okay. So now we can see that it's not equally probable that everywhere at the site there's a strong preference. Almost half the probability is in this one position, which points at this three-letter word, or concentrated in these three overlapping positions, which are three overlapping copies of AAA. If you iterate through that, it converges very rapidly. This is a little graph of the convergence. So cycle one, these are the probabilities versus the position in the sequence. Cycle one is flat. Cycle two, we just looked at. In another about three cycles, it's very close to having completely converged. So one of the characteristics of EM is when you hit a pattern, it converges very rapidly to an answer. And that's something that's actually important. For the other sequence, it looks like this. Sequence probabilities are flat. After one cycle, they go up and they converge quickly. What do they converge to? They converge to 0.33. Okay? They converge to 0.33 because we built into this model that there was one site. There's three identical sites here. They each are a probability of a third because they're identical. Okay. If we used a different model, that wouldn't be necessarily true. All right, so that was a really toy example. Here's a little bit harder example.
just one question. Supposing there is really no motif, does this procedure not converge?
It will find something.
Yeah, okay, so what is it?
Okay, so the overall probability will be, it'll find something with lower overall probability. And that's one of the problems with these methods, is judging whether the motif you found is, in fact, really significant, as opposed to just being unusual in the data set.
Is there has the statistics been worked out for that in terms of generating p-values or e-values, all those types of things, of given random sequences, what the distribution of patterns, best patterns?
It's easy to calculate the p-values given a pattern, what the expected distribution of scores is on random or real sequences.
Given the maximal pattern of this type of procedure on random data?
I don't think so. And that's it's a problem that we still have today. We have a heuristic solution to it, which is really Gary Starma's solution.
What type of distribution does it follow? Is it something EDD-ish or something like that?
Yeah. I mean, it's a similar kind of thing.
Something Walter-ish?
Extreme value distribution.
Okay, so these are a set of real DNA sequences. These came out of a paper that was in the Annual Review of Biochemistry when I was a graduate student, so it's a little old now. But these are real bacterial promoter sequences, E. coli promoter sequences, aligned at the RNA start point, which would be here. So that should bring the promoter elements in them into approximate registration, but you can see it's pretty hard looking at this to tell what the promoter sequence is. Okay. The bacterial promoter has two conserved regions. One's 10 bases upstream from the RNA start. The other one's about 35 bases upstream. So there should be one in here somewhere. This is really hard back in 1979 when nobody had a clue what the promoter looked like. Okay, so we set up a very similar model. This one has six positions. We loaded at cycle one, again, with information-less matrix. Now, this is not what you would do in a real practical situation. In a practical situation, you would almost certainly load this with randomized values, or at least quasi-randomized values, okay? Because you'd be almost certain to get into a non-global optimum using something like that. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, as you cycle through each cycle of EM, you can watch the probabilities of these converge. And really, by the eighth cycle, they really have converged. And we can read off the sequence. And it's T, A, T, T, A, T. Okay? That is, in fact, the bacterial minus 10 promoter sequence. And except for picking the sequences, I didn't build it in. And there are the sequences that are found. You can see they're sort of almost in registration, but not quite. In a few cases, this is the site that was actually labeled in the paper in 1979. This is the site we found. I don't think you'd want to generalize from such a small number of sequences, but I think you could argue this might be more relevant. I think spacing was an important feature in picking this one. And again, this one here, as opposed to this one might actually, I think, arguably be better than the one that was in the paper. There's two overlapping predictions here.
Isn't there another G after the last T?
Which?
TG.
TG.
Last one. TATATG.
Yeah. Yes. The biggest feature of this is these three center bases are really not very strongly conserved. So the ones that really matter is this T and this T, and to a lesser extent this A. This is not uncommon for DNA sites, where if you look at the physics of the DNA, there's a sitedness to the molecule. Okay, you can mostly detect the base sequence by looking in the major groove of the DNA, and it turns away from you. What is it, about 35 degrees every base pair.
So wait, what is the N underlined in the figure?
These were cases where there were actually a major and a minor site. I didn't show you the probabilities, but if you look at the probabilities versus the position, each one of these lines is a sequence. Okay, so for the third sequence, there's a major probability peak and a minor peak. For the second one, there's an even more pronounced minor peak.
And the fold is what they predicted in the original paper?
Yeah. Which was very much a research paper. I think people wouldn't completely agree with all those predictions today. Okay, so that's the simple method. Now, there's a lot of little things that make that not a very useful method for real life. So one is you have to know exactly how many motifs there are. You have to know exactly how wide the motifs are. You have to be, one of the things we're interested in is recovering multiple motifs. Okay, this just shows you how to get one. How do you get more than one? A lot of these things are in the implementation of the MEME program. Okay, so first of all, normally in EM, the way you would avoid the problem of the fact that it's not a global solution is you would load your initial matrix and run it a lot of different times with a lot of different sets of random values. And you would presumably see that some majority of the time it converged to something, and then you'd be convinced you'd found the global optimum solution. MEME does something I think a little more intelligent, which is it rests on the intuition that, in fact, if you have a training set of sequences, that the motif you want to find is in there. Okay, so why load your initial starting matrices with random sequences? Instead, we load it with subsequences from the actual training set, blurred up with a background distribution. Okay, that way, if there is a motif in there, we'll start out close to it. Run two cycles of EM. I showed you that EM will converge very rapidly if you're close to a solution. If one of those sample positions is close to a real motif, after two cycles of EM, you can tell it's starting to converge. So pick the ones that look like they're candidates, iterate them to convergence. Then loop over a set of different model widths to find the right width for the model. Okay, that gives you one motif of whatever set of widths you've sampled. Then how do you go back and get the next motifs? Now the answer to that is what we call probabilistic erasing. So what you do is you start out with a view of each sequence. Okay, instead of really thinking of it as this is a C or a T, this is a count. Okay, so we start out with 1.0 Cs here, 1.0 Ts here, 1.0 Ts here. After we find the first motif, the probability that this is a site is 0.8. We now make this 0.2 of a T, 0.2 of an A, 0.2 of a C. Okay. So maximum likelihood estimation part, you're going to weight not only by the probability of the site, but also the times the weight of the actual characters in the site. So that once you've found it, it's effectively removed from the sample. So that's a greedy search technique. It's approximate, but it actually works pretty well. Mostly because this first cycle of testing for sites that look like they're going to converge is pretty efficient at finding the most probable or close to the most probable ones. Okay, models. Okay, so I said the first model I showed you is the model we call the OOPS model.
Question, how do you find the best width? I mean, how do you compare
sample lots of different widths. Use a heuristic kind of, it's similar to a Bonferroni kind of statistic. Because obviously the wider widths will always have higher overall probability. The OOPS model is the one I showed you, the one where we start out positing that there's one and exactly one occurrence of whatever site we're looking for in each sequence. That's generally a bad model, and the reason it's a bad model is because almost any data set you get from biologists is significantly contaminated with garbage. Sometimes 30, 40, 50% sequences in fact have nothing to do with what you're looking for. So a much better one is this model here, and this is one we use most of the time, called the Zoops model, which says there's zero or one occurrence of the motifs. And if you want to see the exact probability expressions that allow you to encapsulate this model versus this model, or this third model, which is the one that allows any number of repetitions of the motif in any of the sequences, I will point you at Tim Bailey's thesis, because it's all worked out in agonizing detail in his thesis. I should say before I go on that almost all of this work, except for a few of the ideas, definitely all of the implementation and all but a few of the ideas in this work, is Tim Bailey's work, who's one of my co-workers at SDSC. Okay, so that's... So the other thing I wanted to say is, if you run... you ran an early version of Meme, you would find often that you would get out you'd get out a motif that instead of detecting a single pattern like these ones do, is you might find that several columns, maybe one, the first, third, and fourth columns would sort of be identifying one motif, and the second, fifth, and sixth columns would be identifying another motif, because essentially you had more parameters in your model than were necessary to identify a single site, and the total probability is higher by identifying two sites that are different than by just identifying one site. Okay, so that's what we called the convex combination problem. And that's a problem not only with Meme, this is a problem we used to have with the Gibbs sampler all the time too. And it just has to do with the fact that you're optimizing the total probability, and it's often better to find two moderately good solutions than one not so good solution. It has a higher probability but hits fewer sequences. Higher probability per sequence, but it hits fewer sequences. So the answer to that was to use a concept that we called the mega prior concept. And that's basically the same concept as I already talked about in terms of profiles and hidden Markov models. It comes down to looking at these columns and replacing the observed frequencies with some set of frequencies that come from a model that you think has biological relevance. So if you, in fact, look at a protein, one of these matrices for a protein, and you see all the significantly high probabilities are all hydrophobic residues, but you have some additional probability for acidic residues, it makes more sense to use this hydrophobic distribution that we know makes biological sense and throw away these extra things. Okay, so that can be done using a Dirichlet mixture prior, that can be done using a column out of a PAM matrix, a column out of a Blossom matrix. Okay, and basically what it means is you substitute your observed data, you substitute in for that a model chosen based on the observed data. And that can be a mixture model if you like.
How does this perform on a set of proteins?
We use it on proteins all the time.
Last part of my sentence is, as a such protein that can be divided into two totally unrelated families.
In that case, you should find two sets of motifs, one from each set, that will be basically mutually exclusive, assuming you use this Zoops model.
Has this been done, for instance, I'm thinking of tRNA synthetases?
I haven't explicitly tried it. You could try it. There's a website that runs it, so it's not too hard to run.
Would there be any advantage of explicitly putting in a mixture of memes directly and optimizing for the mixture of memes rather than searching for them sequentially?
That, I think, has an idea with a lot of merit. It won't work inside the general structure of this algorithm, I think. Now, what it will work in within it would be some sort of Gibbs sampler algorithm. That what I described is how you get the motif descriptions. There's also a searching tool for that that allows you to learn motifs from a training set and then search them against a database, calculating the p-value for simultaneous matching to the multiple motifs, which was a problem that kept Tim busy for about 6 months. What you get out of it is a set of motifs. This is what comes out of meme. A motif here, this is an example of the real motif that was learned. These black bars bracket with the motif that was learned. So these are all the instances of the sequences that matched the motif that was learned in the training set of sequences. And then these sequences out here, the flanking sequences that didn't match. And you can see there's a dramatic difference in the amount of similarity in here versus what you have on the two sides.
Do you still have the same sampling problems that you do in terms of needing to cull sequences and things like that?
You can use very contaminated data sets. Uh-huh. You can weight sequences if you like, although a lot of times what we do rather than weighting is purge. So purging means we just run a program that throws out sequences that are within some distance of other sequences, choosing the one that's sort of the most in the center to keep. Because the learning step of meme is quadratic in the length of the training set, it's an advantage actually to purge and make the data set learning training set smaller in a lot of cases.
Why is it quadratic? Is it just because there's hardcore iteration?
Because you sample every possible position in every sequence in the training set as a starting point, mm-hmm. and then you have to loop over each motif in each width of motif. It's quite an expensive process, all in all. Once you learn a motif, then you can search with it. And this is the kind of output you might get. So in what I said, you'll notice I said we didn't put any constraints on multiple motifs. We learned them independently in a greedy fashion. So that actually allows us to do something kind of nice when we get to this point. So here you would have, these first ones would be the training set. Okay, they should all have the motifs you're interested in, or this one seems to have one extra one. These sequences down here would be the things that are potentially matching. And you can see there's some pretty prominent effects, or pretty prominent order, spacing and order. So this 512, 512, sort of a big space in 4 is pretty prominent, but especially the 512, okay? Then you have some other things. So here you have one that's 712 with a 5 down. That's not a 5, that's something else, a 6 down here. So you might wonder if the p-value for this match was not convincing. In fact, you can use that order and spacing information, at least qualitatively, to give you a second independent piece of information. So we didn't constrain the order and spacing in the learning process. So that's actually kind of nice, and especially when you get down to very high p-values, and you're trying to distinguish right at the borderline of the noise, that's very useful. Some of these you can tell are likely to be some kind of weird artifact, like this one. This is probably some strange thing where some huge segment was computationally added to the end of this gene when they called the gene for this protein, because we know there's not any real sequences that look like this, as far as we know. Here's one that's quite likely to have been prematurely terminated computationally when they predicted the gene from the genomic sequence. Okay, so what I just told you ought to make you wonder if really knowing something that order and spacing is so important, why don't you include that into the model? Well, you can do that, and you can do that in a number of ways. One of the ways to do it is using something called MetaMeme, which was Bill Grundy's thesis work. Bill Grundy's now an assistant professor at Columbia. The basic idea is to make something called a motif hidden Markov model, where instead of each blocks, each insert state in the hidden Markov model emitting one residue, now it's going to emit a block of residues that corresponds to one of these meme motifs. So first you run meme, find motifs, then you make a model that looks like this. Every motif is connected to every other one in every possible order. You run the training set past there and iterate to modify these probabilities into the most probable order based on that training data, and you come out with what's called a motif hidden Markov model. So the advantage of that is that model has significantly fewer free parameters in it than the one residue per sequence position standard hidden Markov model. So one of the troubles with these hidden Markov models is training them, because you have a larger number of parameters to train and you can't always get a big enough training set. So in theory, this should be much better, both because smaller number of free parameters and because it enforces this order and potentially the spacing depending on how you implement. So far it hasn't worked perfectly, but we actually think we know why that is, and just nobody's had time to really make a solution to it. But I think that's a model that is really attractive for the future, and maybe less for proteins and more for DNA sequences, so more for promoter-like elements, that you can actually find a bunch of elements that look like promoters. They're short, gapless, conserved DNA sequences. Then actually learn potential patterns for combining them together, because we know eukaryotic promoters are very complicated. They have numbers of different kinds of sites. Not every site has every kind. And order and spacing are huge issues. So questions on meme? MetaMeme. Okay, so let me talk about the very last thing.
In a sense, MetaMeme is just taking motifs themselves as the units and then allowing yourself some freedom of finding the super motif that exists.
So to learn the transitions between them, basically keeping those static, although that's an issue in how to implement MetaMeme, is whether you should relearn the emission probabilities within those meme units or not. And but the actual correct solution seemed to be to do something in between, to not let all the parameters free at one time, but to keep the emission probability static and learn the transition parameters, then to freeze the transition parameters and relearn the emission parameters.
In a protein, it's very unlikely that the order of the motifs is going to be changed. I would like...
Not completely true. And one thing you can get out of this model, I didn't show them, but you're going to have self loops, so you can learn repetitions as well.
Oh, in that case, yes. But it would be maybe useful to have them in case there is some contradiction with the most common arrangement of motifs, or if some motifs are missing, it would be maybe interesting to re-predict the gene and look for mistakes.
Absolutely, yeah. We haven't quite got the point of being able to do that yet, but for instance, some of the work we're doing with protein kinases, where we have now 1,000 predictions of gene models for protein kinases from Arabidopsis, definitely fewer than 10% of those have ever been worked on in any kind of laboratory. We know, or we think we know, there's about a 30 to 40% incidence of significant error in the gene models. Those are usually missing exons, especially missing 5' exons, or errors in the intron exon boundaries. Those show up in the protein sequences as missing blocks of conserved sequence. So it's actually pretty easy to tell from the kinases when that happens. But it's a pretty huge job going through 1,000 or more of them, and we're just getting started.
So in the whole thing about multiple alignment, you said that this morning, okay, there's phylogeny, structure function relationship. But maybe there is another one, which is finding errors.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Although you have to be very cautious, probably more cautious than we are, about correcting those errors, because some of those errors are real changes that inactivate the gene.
Well,
making it into a pseudogene. We know that happens sometimes. We're in grave danger, I think, of correcting things that are really, in fact, they're real errors that break the protein, and we would be inclined to correct them. So it's a tricky subject. All right, let me talk very briefly about another method, which is not our method, but at least in my mind, is closely related. Tim doesn't always agree with me. I think of it as a sampled form of EM, and that's this Gibbs sampler method. And I'm only going to talk about it in the context of the way it works with sequences, but it's, again, a general optimization technique. So in the sort of classic Gibbs sampler method, you start knowing some number of sites and some width of a motif. Just the same thing, you're going to learn the same sort of a weight matrix possum kind of pattern as with mean, but you're going to go about it differently. And the way you do it is you start with just randomly setting down a site in each sequence. From that, you calculate what the pattern is. Then you remove one sequence and its site, and you scan just that one sequence to get the probabilities at each position as a site. And then weighted by those probabilities, you pick a new site. Okay, so you're not necessarily going to pick the most probable site. You're just going to use a probabilistically weighted die to choose a site. Okay, and you iterate through that. And this choice can be by a ratio if you want a probability of the model to some background model. Okay, and you iterate. And you iterate. And you iterate. And you may iterate a long time. And if you look at some sort of plot of the information, high being good information in the pattern, and these are thousands of iterations, sometimes you pretty quickly hit on a pattern and converge. Sometimes it may take a while. This is three separate runs on the same data. Okay. So first time it converged quickly, second time less quickly, third time took longer. Is it guaranteed to converge? No. It's pretty probable that it will, but it's not guaranteed to ever actually find anything. These solutions will be somewhat different. It's quite likely, especially given that this one has lower information per position than that one, that, in fact, those are probably overlapping, but not identical solutions. But there's a lot of things you can do with this Gibbs sampler technique, and one of the things you can do is you can learn multiple sites all at the same time. You can have, for instance, three sites per sequence, learning them simultaneously. You do learn a background model simultaneously. I didn't mention it. Meme really does that too. You can actually shuffle. One of the more clever things that Chip Lawrence and his group have done more recently is when you have multiple sites, you don't really know the width. How do you modify the width? And the answer, one answer they came up with is you basically can take sites that aren't being used, they have low information content from one motif, and give them to another and let it grow and be bigger. So that's a pretty clever solution, I think. The big downside to this model is it's completely undeterministic. You know, have no idea how many cycles it might take to converge, or in fact, if it ever will, but you think it will. So it's worth looking at. I think there's enough literature on this to look at, but I won't. I'll just leave it to you guys to look at if you're interested.
You have a comparison of your method in the same sequence compared to the Gibbs sampler?
No, I didn't think to do that. There's not that many public places to run the Gibbs sampler. I'm not even sure there's a server somewhere that we can run. Do you know if there is? We've downloaded their code and used it for different things. I think the Gibbs sampler idea is probably a more generally useful technique. You can apply it to a broader range of applications. And we've thought lots of times of reframing meme as a Gibbs sampler application. One of the reasons is because we could do that kind of application very efficiently on a highly parallel computer, and meme is not very efficient in that way, so we can't speed it up like we could speed up a Gibbs sampling algorithm.
is there a conceptual difference between meme and Gibbs sampler? I mean, you mentioned that there's this...
Well, I think that, to me, the difference is meme is exhaustive. It tries every possible position as a starting point, and that the Gibbs sampler is sampled, so it does a lot less work at each iteration, but it has to do a lot more iterations. Meme actually converges pretty quick. It takes fewer than 10 iterations, I think, on average, per motif, per width.
So if you took the Gibbs sampler database and replicated it a large number of times, then you would end up with a meme approach. Because what you would do is you would statistically have things weighted by their probabilities.
I don't know what you mean by the Gibbs sampler database.
In other words, if you took the Gibbs sampler where you had 8 sequences, and you took those 8 sequences and replicated them 100 times, so you had 800 sequences, of which 100 were identical, 100 were identical uh-huh. the way through, then what the stochasticity would all average out, and you would have the meme algorithm, where you would be assigning things probabilistically rather than
I'm not seeing it, I guess. It doesn't seem like it to me. So what you save in the Gibbs sampler is you don't have to evaluate the probabilities for every sequence in every cycle. You only have to evaluate one sequence. And then you don't calculate the maximum likelihood estimation of the pattern over all possible sites. You just randomly choose one biased by probability. So those are two major savings per cycle time. And then the trade-off is that it takes a lot more cycles to actually. What you have to do is you have to eventually stumble on at least two instances of the same pattern that are aligned before you can get started. So it would seem to me to make a lot more sense if you wanted to make a faster Gibbs sampler to like preload it with pairs of sequences that have been aligned by dynamic programming or something like that. And then you could actually guarantee that you had a starting thing, or to use the idea we used in meme, which was that if you have a set of sequences and you're looking for a motif, the motif is probably in there, why don't you sample from the sequences?
There's no reason why, if the window size you want to end up in the end with the motif is not clear a priori, why don't you use these fixed window sizes and scan one by one?
So that's what meme does, is it scans over, it doesn't do it one by one, but it does starts with a window size of 6 or 8 and then increases the window width by a factor of square root of 2 at each iteration. Why square root of 2? No particular reason. It sounded like a good number.
So why wouldn't we want to do this?
Why would you not want to do it? Or?
Why would I want to do this? If it's not clear a priori how long the motif is I'm looking for, then I could just use the profile of the variable length. Like I do in the standard.
The best window will depend a lot on your training set. So if you have a training set that's quite similar and doesn't have a lot of insertions and deletions between sequences, then you can learn a very long motif. But if you have, because we're only learning gapless blocks here, if you have a diverse training set, you'll be limited to rather short motifs. And without doing some sort of preliminary analysis to figure out a range, it's hard to predict, I think.
So is it clear that it's always gapless?
Well, in this method, and the rationale is that the gaps tend to fall in unconserved regions between conserved motifs. In fact, learning the conserved blocks that bracket the gaps is sufficient. You can, that's an opinion.
So in the, what you call MEME, that's called modified, multiple, whatever, expectation mechanism.
I think it means motif elicitation by maximization of expectation, but you have to blame that on Charles Elkin, not on me.
Remember those.
That was Tim's thesis advisor.
So the major difference between that and EM, the original EM, is because you start with different kind of test frequency.
I don't think there's anything hugely different from the original EM. We just don't do as much random. We do a more directed sampling strategy than
but you also
would be normal.
Simultaneous sample several motifs that way, right? Could you simultaneously sort of find out several motifs? Using the method or
You definitely could. It gets a bit complicated to implement, I think. I would defer you to talk to Tim Bailey about the details of why it's difficult. But if you just look at the, in essence, that's to some extent what this the most complicated model that any number of sites per sequence does, is it implements something like that. And it's complicated. Writing the probability expressions is complicated. But, you know, both of these methods can basically, you can make any arbitrarily complicated model, so long as you can write the probability expressions down, then you can put it into the program.
Michael, you mentioned MAST very briefly, MAST, this program, which was motivated alignment and search tool. Could you comment more about what actually it does?
So what comes out of MEME is a set of motifs, and typically we might have 10 or 20 distinct motifs, all of different lengths. Okay, so what MAST does is it takes that input and it scans through a set of sequences, for instance, a database. And it evaluates for each motif an independent probability, independent of all other motifs, that it matches to each sequence. And then it combines those probabilities into a joint probability across all of the motifs that you gave for the multiple matching to each sequence. Okay, and so that's, I can give you the reference to that paper, but that's a paper on how to combine probabilities from individual motif matches into multiple motif matches that we did a couple years ago.
So it makes about the same approach that MetaMeme, isn't it, right?
MAST just is a scanner. MetaMeme actually takes the motifs and does more learning to try to learn the order and the spacing between motifs. And then once you've got that, it doesn't match to that whole model as a single piece. So it doesn't evaluate the independent matching to each motif like MAST does. It just gives a complete probability for the whole model with order. So it's an order-dependent model. MAST is order-independent. Each motif is evaluated independently without any order constraint.
But at MetaMeme, as you have shown the hidden Markov model, it seems like your motifs also can be taken in different order.
It could be, but you're going to learn the weights on those transitions based on your training set. And my assumption being that, in fact, there's a predominant order in your training set, it'll be very biased to a specific order. But not completely. You know, won't completely insist on it, but it'll be strongly biased. Because almost all real biological data, except maybe promoter data, is order is extremely important.
And in case of MEME, just a terminological question. You said expectation maximization as a basic approach, how MEME was done. Where is maximization step?
The maximization is this re-estimation of the pattern, so the maximum likelihood estimation of the pattern.
Because it seems to me like simply normalization of frequencies based on numbers you counted.
I guess you could think of it that way.
But is it, are the cars involved in that step? You mentioned the directional matrix and things like that, in which case you would need an optimization, a maximization step.
I don't think they're involved.
Are there Dirichlet mixtures and other type of prior information included in this, or is it just simply counting?
There is actually a background prior as well. In fact, what MEME actually does is it simultaneously runs a foreground and background model. And so it's looking at the ratio of those.
Maybe that's where it comes.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I'm just curious, how would MEME perform on the following case? Suppose that in your training set you have actually two subsets which share maybe three common motifs, but each subset has five motifs, very clear. And so it may be difficult to find this three common motifs because there are more degenerate go from one subset to the other than when you just learn them one subset. So I'm just curious how the algorithm would perform in such a case?
Well, I think it would depend on exactly how degenerate they were. One of the problems that we have is because of the greedy learning strategy, that once you get down to, and this probabilistic erasing idea, once you get down to features that are not 80 or 90% likely to come from the model, they don't get completely erased. So in effect, the erasing becomes incomplete and you can relearn the same feature or an overlapping feature. So MAST actually does a test for that at the beginning. It looks for correlated features and identifies them for you and tells you which ones are correlated. So the kind of data set you're talking about would be the kind most likely to give rise to that kind of a pattern. So, but I don't know what to say without having a specific test case to look at. I mean, it's clear that mileage may vary depending on what you've got. It is, MEME is one of the most robust methods to lousy data that I've seen, and I think that's probably the most striking feature of it, is you can give it very contaminated data sets and still pull out motifs that are present in less than a majority of the sequences, which I think is pretty impressive given that most of these motif finding methods are exquisitely sensitive to having any noise at all in the training data.
How does that give sampling algorithm deal with missing instances, sequences we don't have?
I think they have a way to deal with that, but I can't remember the details of how they did it. The thing to do is to look up Chip Lawrence's papers, and especially who is the guy that worked with him, Lou Neuwald and Lou.
They're coming March.
So they're going to be here?
Will be
here. Oh, great! That'll be wonderful. So he's an extremely sharp guy.
Does MEME always converge?
It always finds something, yeah. I mean, it's like giving a sixth grader a calculator. They will punch the buttons and come up with an answer. That's actually one of the problems, because you come out of this process with a motif, and it's statistically significant based on the model and the set of sequences. And the question is it biologically significant? And that's hard to know. So we've been using this heuristic of Gary Stormo's, which actually seems to be, it's not perfect, but it gives you at least a guide to deciding before you even run MAST which motifs are significant. And then really functionally, it's the MAST search of the database that gives us our real functional significance, is when we find there's usually a pretty sharp cutoff between the motifs that occur only in the sequence you're interested in, the ones that occur in lots of garbage in the database.
Okay. Any more questions?